think that maybe Bilbo is the guy, because all the dwarves kind of doubt Bilbo, you know, being a hobbit and being this peaceful being and all, he's not really shown much yet that he's going to be able to complete this task. Hello everyone, welcome to episode 23 of the Audiobook Club podcast. My name's Jonathan and I will be hosting today's episode, and I'm joined by Michael and Jason at the minute, and Stephen will be joining us shortly. In this episode we're going to be covering The Hobbit, written by J.R.R. Tolkien and read by Andy Serkis. So, quick summary about the book. The Hobbit, otherwise known as There and Back Again, is a fantasy novel that transports readers to the enchanting world of Middle-earth. First published in 1937, it describes an adventure undertaken by Bilbo Baggins, a wizard named Gandalf, and a company of 13 dwarves. The goal of their journey is to reclaim a stolen treasure and a lost homeland, which is now guarded by a fearsome dragon. So, why did I pick this book? Well, I believe that this book is a timeless masterpiece that appeals to readers of all ages, and also this is a prelude to Tolkien's epic trilogy, The Lord of the Rings, which, in terms of movies, would be my favourite movie franchise, and definitely I'd say is up there with most people. Just want to ask Jason and Michael to give their opinions, their high-level opinions on this book. Had they read it before, what they thought about this the first time they read it, this time they read it, etc. So we'll go over to you first, Michael.
I have read this book. I would say this is probably the fifth or sixth time that I've read The Hobbit. So it's quite a lot of reads of it. The first time I read it, I think I was probably about 18 or 19. It was one of the first books that I read without having to be made to read a book outside of school. I can't really state how much like Middle-earth as a setting, all these stories have had an influence on me, how much the stories mean to me. I've actually been intimidated to do this book because I just don't know how to state it or how to bring it into words, really. And I think a lot of people feel that way. We were all at the age kind of where we were the target audience, we were very young. There was a big target audience, obviously, for Lord of the Rings. It was adults and children both. But we were very young when Lord of the Rings movies came out, and I think that was all impacted us massively. Then years later, I picked up the Hobbit book. So it was quite a breezy enough read. It didn't feel like a big weighty tome to other epic fantasies or fantasy books that I knew. So I thought, yeah, I'll give this a go. It was quite a light and breezy read the first time, and I just devoured it at... It was like a couple of sittings that I think I read it on the first time. I've just returned to it over and over again. Like, you used the word masterpiece, and I think more than any book that we've done on this podcast so far, no book greater deserves that word to be used against it than this book. It is just a masterful piece of storytelling. It is almost a perfect book. You know, it's hard to pick it apart how it isn't. It's just J.R.R. Tolkien. The world he created, the richness of it, and the masterful way with which it's realized on this story. Such a simple story on the surface, an enjoyable adventure, but when you dig deeper, it's got so much depth to it. So yeah, I absolutely love this book, and it's one that I will constantly reread.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with basically what you've all said. Me and Michael, of course, being brothers, grew up together, and we have a family tradition where we watch the Lord of the Rings movies every year on our holidays. So, although maybe the Hobbit movies wouldn't be up there, like the actual just going returning to the world of Middle-earth is just something we do on a yearly basis. So, yeah, I share all the same feelings. What about you, Jason?
Yeah, I remember when you announced that you were picking this last episode. I think was it Michael that said, "Right, well, there Johnny goes, try to get the number one rated book for the 2024."
Yeah,
I was really looking forward to this as well. It was my first time actually listening to the book. I have read the physical copy twice before. I can't remember exactly when I first read it, but I do remember on my reread the second time just fall in love with it over again. I don't know why, just there's certain chapters just really stick with me. Like I'll just hear certain words or certain phrases, and it'll just like the chapter titles will pop into my head, the story will pop in my head. Like, don't know why, but always like the frying pan into the fire. Just whenever I hear like that expression, or first thing I think of is The Hobbit. I mean, yeah, as you also said, like growing up with you guys, like the Lord of the Rings was a big part of our lives. Watching the films, playing the games, pretending to be the characters out in the street. Like, yeah, so
Golly would always choose Legolas.
He would.
Not sort of a chance.
always. I was thinking it should have been Gimli, but anyway. Yeah, no, I was really, really looking forward to this. I think I got started pretty much as quick as I could once it was announced. And yeah, just had a really, really great time with this experience. So I've been looking forward to reviewing it.
You mentioned there that you've read it and this is your first time listening. I've never actually read the physical book. And to be honest, until the movies came out in like 2013, I didn't even really, was not even that aware of The Hobbit. I knew it existed, but I didn't really know much about it, or like that it was like a prequel or anything like that. I'd never taken heed of it. I love The Lord of the Rings. I don't really care about any of the other the other books or anything like that. Obviously, as I've gotten older, I have a deeper interest now in like the whole Tolkien world that he's created. I've never read any of the other, like The Fall of Gondolin or The Silmarillion or anything like that. So I'd like to, you know, get onto those books eventually. But I have listened to The Hobbit once before, but this was the first time I did listen to it with Andy Serkis narrating it. I think like about a year or two ago, they re-released the Hobbit and the three Lord of the Rings books with him narrating. And those, for those that don't know, Andy Serkis is the actor who plays Smeagol or Gollum throughout the series. So he's got quite an interesting voice, and obviously there's bits in this book and the other books where Smeagol comes up. So he is very good at bringing that character to life. But yeah, I guess we can maybe start moving into our actual review, kind of going through the book. So the book opens with Bilbo Baggins. So he is basically a hobbit, which is one of the races of Middle-earth. It's essentially like this peaceful, kind of all they like to do is drink and eat and just chill out and smoke, and they don't like engaging with the outside world too much or going on any mad adventures. They just enjoy the peaceful life. And basically Bilbo at his house is just, you know, doing exactly that, just chilling out, and Gandalf the wizard appears. So Gandalf is kind of known by the hobbits, but he's known as a disturber of the peace, and he's known as well for his fireworks. They don't really know much else about Gandalf or anything outside that he does, but he basically appears and asks Bilbo, does he want to go on an adventure? Bilbo's like, no, we don't like adventures around here. But yeah, Gandalf just knows that this is the man that for the job, which I'll cover in 2 seconds. So basically Gandalf marks Bilbo's house, and then at that evening a bunch of dwarves show up, 13 dwarves in total, show up at Bilbo's house and wreak havoc, eating his food and things like that. And they explain to Bilbo that they need what they describe as a burglar to come on a quest with them to reclaim their homeland from a dragon named Smaug. So what do you guys think of this whole opening scene with the whole setting of the Shire, the description of the hobbits, and then this interruption by the company of dwarves and Gandalf?
Yeah, contrary to my usual opinion of the opening of books, actually, I mean, it helps that I have read it before and have watched the movies and have pretty good experience with the characters already, so I was sucked in straight away. I think it really does a brilliant job of setting the scene initially and sort of laying out, you know, like the basic plot of the book. You know, it's telling us what's going to happen. We're going to go and get this treasure from this big dragon. Like, it's what a way to start the book, and just what's better than knowing there's a big scary dragon at the end of the book? What more could you want? I mean, between the individual hobbits or the dwarves, apologies, I do feel like some maybe just don't get as fleshed out as others. But it's good to sort of get introduced to all of them. initially and just get like a bit of a get to know a bit of their quirks to begin with. But as I say, there's definitely some dwarves that I find get fleshed out a bit more than others in this book. And then of course, well, we meet Gandalf. Probably not most people's first time meeting Gandalf, but Bilbo clearly knows him from the past. I think, don't know if it really goes into too much detail in the book, but they are aware of each other. So he's not like a complete stranger. Whereas in the movie, because I have watched the movie, I think it is made out to be a bit more like Bilbo's not really too sure who Gandalf is at the beginning. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed the opening chapter of this book. I think it really just sets the scene perfectly. It really describes the Shire and just the perfect little quaint life that Bilbo has and just gets us ready for the adventure ahead.
Yeah, Michael?
Yeah, it's a very quaint and cozy, quaint and cozy. It's a very quaint and cozy kind of introduction to this world. And yeah, it's just like, because we're introduced to such an alien kind of world, it's unlike our own. But openings are supposed to kind of anchor you into familiarity, and they're supposed to kind of set a scene for something normal where a situation is to be introduced. So how are you supposed to set a scene that feels normal when everything is different, you know, in this world? Well, we have this way of life which is very familiar to a lot of us, especially, you know, people who are from like small villages, small towns. You know, this is a very familiar kind of setup where everything's just slow down. It's very relatable, where so much of life is based on like what are you going to eat next, what are you going to drink next. So it's just very relatable in that way, and that kind of way of life is very familiar. Then we have like characters like, yeah, Gandalf and Bilbo. It's hard to even talk about them as characters because they're so ingrained into culture. It's like saying, well, what do you think of Jesus as a character? You know, it's just they're hard to even analyze as characters because they feel so real, and they've been with us for so long. But yeah, they're incredibly well fleshed out characters. Everything that Tolkien does is incredibly well fleshed out. We have the dwarves. Obviously, we can't get a full spectrum of every dwarf though, because there's too many of them to go on to them all, and this would be a much bigger book if they all were got to go on to that way. But I found it was quite a humorous introduction to them too, with everybody being brought onto Bilbo's home, everybody taking his food, and Bilbo being quite stressed to be the perfect server to all of them, the perfect host. And then the songs, which I know you guys have mentioned, I think some of you guys have mentioned in the past, you're not fans of songs being in books. I like the songs in this book, and I thought the way Andy Serkis brought the songs to life was very entertaining, and I enjoyed that aspect. So yeah, I thought it was a very strong opening.
And I would agree about the songs as well, Mike. You know, I've actually quite enjoyed them.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely me who said mostly about like not liking songs. I think the songs in this aren't as bad. Like, I do enjoy the songs in this. I think the actual ones in Lord of the Rings books. But then that might be down to the narrator too. Like, I think Andy Serkis is entertaining to listen to while he's singing, whereas I think whoever it is that the other ones versions I listen to
Rob,
wasn't.
Rob Ingress that the previous versions.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think like which isn't, you know, fair maybe on the narrator, because like, you shouldn't have to be a good singer to be a narrator or whatever, but I didn't have any issue with the songs in this. And I feel like in Lord of the Rings, the actual Lord of the Rings trilogy books, there's more singing. I think in this it just had a few songs here and there, which was perfect. My point on this opening chapter, would like to agree with a lot of what you guys said. It's, you know, quite, it's nice that it's got this like cozy opening, and then it just, you know, it just, this situation just arises and everything's a bit urgent all of a sudden. It's kind of like an abrupt, like a way to kind of disturb this quietness and this peaceful life, which is makes you feel exactly how Bilbo must have felt, you know, his life kind of getting rattled by this intrusion. But yeah, I like the description of the setting. It is very like fairy tale, almost describing the way the Shire and the Hobbits are described. It just sounds like a children's story at this point. But I think, yeah, from this point in the book onwards, then essentially from the introduction of the dwarves, this book is basically nonstop. I feel like the pace is very temperate throughout this, or like the same kind of high tempo throughout it. Whereas, you know, you just start at this low tempo, and then automatically, you know, you go from 0 to 100 and you're up at 100 then for the rest of the book. I quite like that. But yeah, I think the quest description as well is quite intriguing. You know, that it's just a classic kind of fantasy. You're going on a quest to fight a dragon and get some gold. You know, it's just very, very fantasy. Like, I'm sure you could almost say a stereotype now, but I'm sure this is probably what created that kind of that story. Like, I'm sure it didn't probably exist before this, because I do know a lot of this, like orcs and goblins and all that kind of stuff was like came from Tolkien. So I think that it's an interesting setup. Stephen has actually joined us now. Welcome, Stephen. We missed you there.
Hello. Thanks. Some loud fella was like, some mad loud fella told me to look for a rune on a door, and I couldn't find it.
So, Stephen, we just want to get you to catch us up on what you thought about The Hobbit.
I mean, you can't say anything really bad about it. Like, I mean, it's one of the classics. Loved it. I heard some things you guys were saying about the music, or the songs. I'm kind of mixed feelings about the songs. I think most of the time it was okay, but some of the times I thought it like detracted a wee bit from what was going on. But I mean, overall it was fine. And I know that like music is a big part of the Tolkien's universe, so it's fine. Yeah, I liked it. I like how it's very to the point, and you know, jumps at everything, just gets going. And it's, I think I heard you say it just non-stop as soon as the dwarves are introduced, and I think that's 100%. And I really liked it for that, which is weird for me because I like a more well-defined sort of backstory for things. But I kind of liked it here where it just jumps into it. Yeah, it was good. It's a good book.
I was just going to touch on something you said, Jonathan, where you said like Tolkien kind of ushered on this structure. I think it's worth mentioning he was very influenced himself by like fairy tales and structures of like Norse mythology and stories like Beowulf, which has like an intelligent talking dragon on it and has a lot of parallels to the story. So he definitely he definitely had left his own influences as well in sculpting this story.
Yeah, I'm sure as many of the greats do. Like, I'm sure even the people that wrote like Beowulf like got theirs from some folk story that just hadn't been written down yet. Like, I'm sure, every story has some kind of influence.
And we did a book about Norse mythology on this show before, and I think we discussed like how so much of the stories are about, instead of this brawny character who overcomes with muscle, so much of them was about like tricking characters. So I think that you can see a lot of that in this story too, that Bilbo gets a lot of his victories by just outsmarting.
Yeah.
You know, his adversary.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's actually like he's a very kind of, it's because he's so small and stuff, he's able to like slip through things with unseen and things. I think that's what Gandalf describes him, like why he says he's the perfect person to the dwarves for being this burglar, because he's, they can move unseen.
Yeah.
So, Stephen, we've covered our reviews of what we thought about the first chapter. Do you want to give a quick summary of what you thought?
It was good. I liked it. Quick enough.
Short and sweet.
Moving on. So, chapter 2 is the chapter where they basically venture out into the wilderness. So Bilbo does, although he's quite reluctant to accept the quest, he does join them on the quest, which I kind of speaks a little bit to his character. I think Gandalf describes whenever he's talking about Bilbo that is like he's a Baggins, which is like a stereotypical hobbit that loves the quiet and all, but he's also got this adventurous side in him from the Took side. So I think that Bilbo just couldn't resist the temptation of an adventure. So it turned out he kind of was probably the perfect hobbit to ask, because probably the other hobbits would not have agreed. But yeah, they set out on their journey, Gandalf, the 13 dwarves, and Bilbo, and quickly encounter the first challenge, which is the trolls, the cave trolls. So I believe the trolls are like a creature that can only like be out at night, and they are like turned to stone by the sun. So this is currently happening at night, and the trolls essentially capture Bilbo and the dwarves and are trying to figure out the best way to cook them and stuff. And at this stage, Gandalf has slipped off somewhere, and then he comes to the rescue. And like, I can't remember how it happens in the book, but in the movie, it's like he splits the stone and lets the sun hit them, because the sun is starting to rise or whatever.
I think it's the same thing.
Yeah, probably similar kind of idea. But yeah, it kind of brings me to a point of like this book where Gandalf always seems to kind of like slip off at points. He does this in the Lord of the Rings trilogy as well. He like slips off and then he just appears just when you need him. He's kind of that character. But yeah, what do you think of the first kind of encounter with like an actual danger as such?
Yeah, again, I just find the scene with the trolls just quite iconic and something that sort of gets referenced in the actual Lord of the Rings movies as well, pretty sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think they pass it in the Fellowship.
Yeah, it does.
Sam finds him or something.
They just
Bilbo tells a story to you at his birthday.
Yeah, I think they just walk past them. And they're definitely like
some deleted scene as well. Where like, I think it's a deleted scene in the film where like they're resting there or something.
It's when Frodo's freaking tripping after he gets stabbed, and then Sam's like, "Look, it's Mr. Bilbo's trolls."
Look, Mr. Frodo. Taters.
We could really go off the beaten track in this review, can't we? Just Lord of the Rings references. No, it's
your Sam.
It's me. It's your Sam.
Don't you know your Sam?
Anyways, Jason.
This is not going well, is it? No, it's good. As you sort of said, like it's Bilbo quite quickly changed his mind to actually come on the adventure. So I think Gandalf knew the type of person he was and that he would be sort of swayed quite easily to join them. And how he secretly did want to get out of Hobbiton, out of the Shire. But yeah, that once they sort of reach the trolls and that sort of scene where Gandalf tricks them into like fighting with each other until the sun comes up, I quite enjoy it. Because I think there was a fair amount of peril involved. Because it's like already, like what, chapter 2, chapter 3, and like they're already in quite severe danger of getting killed and eaten. So as Johnny sort of said, like it really just goes from like 0 to 100 as soon as they leave Bilbo's gaff, and I'm all for it. I don't think it slows down really at all. So good, again, just good. Keeps a good time rolling.
Michael?
Yeah, I really enjoy this part. I was gonna say before Jason pointed it out, like, do you ever see the meme Once Upon a Time in Hollywood where Leo is like pointing because he recognizes something?
Yeah.
That was like, when I first read The Hobbit, that was me with this scene. I was like, oh, that's the story that Bilbo was telling on his birthday to all the kids. I really, really enjoyed this chapter. I thought it was very, very funny. And it was kind of, again, it's very clear this is like a children's book at its heart. This kind of whole fairy tale thing of the fear of getting eaten by something bigger. It's like a predominant threat in a lot of fantasy children stuff. And then, you know, Gandalf outsmarting the trolls, basically from within the bushes casting out his voice, and then revealing the sun on him. It's, as Jason used the perfect word for it, it's a very iconic scene. It's one of the most memorable scenes, I think, probably from the book.
Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, it's another good scene. Gandalf's a wild crafty, so he has it with everything he does, so it's not surprising that he was able to trick the trolls. Now you see him tricking, obviously, Bilbo to go on the journey. He does a thing with Beorn later on, so he's a wild crafty bugger. I find it a bit mad that none of the dwarves brought like weapons with them as well on this perilous journey. Or it seems like that anyway. They just sort of turn up to try and box the trolls after Bilbo gets caught, but
I think they find the weapons afterwards, don't they?
Aye, that's
the
thing.
They stumble on
some weapons. Like, you think you're going on this journey to like kill a dragon, or you're very likely to encounter a dragon, and you don't bring like, you know, weapons and that. Probably going to see orcs and goblins and all as well, but no, just fisticuffs. It's the dwarvish way. Anyway, I think there's a lot of like world building in this too, where the trolls, like how it's kind of described that they've come down from the mountains and stuff, like they've been forced out in that, and how they have to hide in a cave and all, so you kind of get the you know, the aversion to light stuff and all that. So there's a lot in this chapter, and I think it was really well put together. And yeah, liked it. I like that, you know, the burglar kind of fails at the start and stuff.
Yeah, it shows you the trolls, like, live together, you know. So they're not solitary creatures, you know. You're getting all sorts. Like, they like to sit down and have their dinner together. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of descriptions. And, yeah, myself find this it's very wholesome. Even if they are eating people, like, but... Yeah, like Michael said, it's a very classic kind of fairy tale thing with these something bigger than you trying to eat you. But I think this does it in a, like the fairy tale way. It's kind of quite comic, quite silly, but also still has the sense of urgency and danger there. I think the balance is just brilliantly done in this book. I'll move on then to, I'll kind of go over, do a short description here of the next three chapters. So, like you were saying there, they after the trolls are defeated and turned to stone, they stumble upon the troll cave, and there are elvish weapons within them. I believe Thorin, who we haven't even mentioned yet, but Thorin is the supposed to be heir to the throne of Thrall, which is the kingdom that they're actually trying to go and reclaim here. He basically gets this sword that's called like the Goblin Cleaver. So that comes up now in a minute.
Thorkrist.
Yeah, Gandalf gets himself a sword as well. And then the scene that I like is, you know, Bilbo getting the sword. He doesn't name it yet, but when he names the sword Sting eventually. And there's a scene in Lord of the Rings in the movies. It's like, you know, whenever Frodo first encounters Sméagol and like goes, "This is Sting. You've seen it before, haven't you?" And I was always like, what's he on about in that scene? Like, well, like obviously that was a big reference to the... Bilbo having met Sméagol or Gollum before, but yeah, that always confused me until I'd read this book and like was like, oh, that's what it is. I don't even know Frodo's sword was called Sting. Like I had no idea. So basically, they find this treasure and stuff within this troll cave, and then they seek refuge at Rivendell, just to rest up for a bit and get some guidance from Elrond. And there's obviously throughout Middle-earth and all, there's this kind of hatred of between dwarves and elves, or kind of like a distrust almost, because I believe the mountain was taken in the first place, the elves never came to the aid. There's a lot of that in Lord of the Rings, you know, where's Gondor and all that. There's a lot of people not coming to other people's aid. So there's a lot of distrust there. So they need the elves' help to read this map. So the map is essentially like it contains like a secret way into the mountain, you know, without having to go through the main entrance and trigger the dragon or whatever. But they can't read the map without the help of the elves. So yeah, they seek Elrond's help, who's like basically the leader of the elves at Rivendell, and eventually get his help. And they figure out that there is a door in the mountain, a secret door, and dwarven doors are like invisible until like a certain day of the year, which this one is for Durin's Day, which is like their ancestors' holiday, their biggest holiday or whatever. But it's like you know, the moon light or the light of Durin's Day or whatever will shine on and reveal the door. But yeah, so they're able to figure that out with the guidance from Elrond, and then they leave Rivendell. They head over a mountain pass, and there's a big storm, and they seek refuge in a cave. And then in that cave, again, Gandalf is able to kind of sneak off when this happens, but they encounter goblins who capture them and take them into like deeper in the cave, into their like internal like goblin lair place. And at the point of like capture and stuff, Bilbo, I think, is tussling with one of the goblins, and they both like fall off like the edge of like the cliff, or like off the edge and inside the mountain, and like he's basically lost from the rest of the group. The rest of the group are taken to the Goblin King, where Gandalf eventually shows up and they kind of battle their way out. But as for Bilbo, this is kind of a very iconic scene of him encountering Gollum after Bilbo has found the One Ring. Obviously the One Ring in this book is just this kind of thing that is for Bilbo to kind of turn invisible and, you know, kind of sneak around and get his job done and things like that. the actual significance of the ring isn't really explored until the Lord of the Rings trilogy. But yeah, this is where we encounter Gollum for the first time. And as I mentioned before, Andy Serkis, who narrates this, is the actor who plays Gollum. So he's got the iconic Gollum voice, which he does, again, quite perfectly in this book. And basically, Bilbo and Gollum play a contest of riddles. If Bilbo wins, then Gollum will show him the way out because Bilbo's lost. And if Gollum wins, I believe he wants to eat Bilbo because Gollum obviously only gets to eat like goblins and stuff like that in this cave, so he's interested to try something new. But yeah, that's obviously covered a lot of ground there. We'll go over to you again, Michael. What did you think of this kind of section of the book?
Yeah, as both of you, you and Jason, at least, Jonathan, have said repeatedly on about this, is like, it has such, about its pace, it has so breakneck, it's just constantly, it's the classic kind of, it's classic now of like an A to B fantasy journey, and where they're going to be, they encounter so many monsters and so many crazy things on the way, these goblins, these stone giants, it's just a lot of fun. And then you get to the scene with the ring and the scene with Gollum, and it just is completely elevated to everything else, especially with Andy Serkis's performance on this. Listening to this was like chills down my back. It was so good, such a good moment. It's even without his performance, it's probably the best moment in the book, because you know the setup, the riddles and everything, just such a fascinating part of the book. But then with Andy Serkis's performance on top of it, it just brings it to another level. It's just incredible. Fairly enjoyed it.
Yeah, like Andy Serkis, like doing, like, I think the thing for me, there's a lot of people say like online and stuff who can do like good impressions of Gollum. But there's like that, the thing that like kind of sets him apart, or I think he does better, is like the wee breathing, you know, the way Gollum breathes, kind of like he does this kind of hiss almost while he's breathing. Yeah. I think that there, like, because that's the first thing you hear whenever the encounters Gollum, is that sound. And I just, yeah, that's, like you said, that,
yeah, it's like a throaty growl, kind of. I know exactly, yeah, the sound you're talking about. It's, yeah.
Yeah, that for, is the part that's, you know, would send the chills down my spine. Yeah, so Jason, what about you?
Yeah, quite a lot to cover there. But as we sort of keep coming back to, it's quite a lot to cover because there's always something happening. It just never stops. Because even though that's only like 2-3 chapters like summarized, but just so much has actually happened in those 2 or 3 chapters. It's just so dense. Beginning with the Rivendell, I mean, I know I've just literally said I don't think it slows down, but I would say this is, apart from the very beginning, this is probably the slowest bit for the remaining part of the book. Just when they're in and sort of chatting with Elrond and sort of find out where to go and what the map does, but still really enjoyed it. Then once they sort of go through the Misty Mountains and they get into the Goblin Cave, Goblin Cavern, I quite enjoy the bit with the goblins and the Goblin King, Goblin Lord.
Frank King.
Yeah. But then obviously Gandalf and the dwarves just leave Bilbo behind. Didn't realize he was gone. But yeah, like one of the highlights of the book, especially just with Andy Serkis's performance, is the riddles in the dark with Gollum. Yeah, it's pretty scary. I think the voice of Gollum is, yeah, again, quite a lot of peril in the scene, even just for something so silly. Like, you know, it's just telling each other riddles, but it's beautifully written, beautifully acted, great part of the story. Definitely really enjoy this sort of 2 chapters in the cave, from the sort of goblin side of things of the dwarves and then into the Gollum side of things of Bilbo. I think it's one of the strong points of the book, definitely.
Yeah, I don't know if you would all agree with this, but I think, and this is probably the most menacing we ever see Gollum.
Yeah.
In this scene.
Yeah.
And across the entire series.
Well, at the very end of Return of the King, it's pretty,
yeah,
pretty messed up.
At Mount Doom, maybe it's the only time it pips him, you know.
Well, he's full coke fiends, you know. Sort me out. Sort of.
I would really agree with Stephen.
I feel
really
like
just that one time at Mount Doom.
Just that one time, yeah.
I feel like in the Mount Doom, like he's only trying to like get the ring or whatever. By the way, this is all spoilers for the trilogy, but I guess if you're listening to this episode, you probably already read The Lord of the Rings, you know, if you're interested, the audiobook podcast. But yeah, like in this, yeah, he's just doing it because he literally wants to kill Bilbo and eat him. Like, whereas at least in the Lord of the Rings, he's just looking to get the ring back. He doesn't actually care for who lives or dies. He just wants the ring.
Yeah, he's much more of a monster. Like, he's like a boogeyman more in this.
Yeah, because there's a lot more mystery surrounding him. And like, obviously, throughout most of The Lord of the Rings, he's like trying to be Frodo's friend and stuff, and he's kind of got the old, you know, Smeagol kind of post or pre-ring kind of personality back. But yeah, Stephen, what about you?
Yeah, it's a good section again. The start of it was kind of annoying though, with the elves. The elf singing really annoys me. I don't know why. Don't like the elves.
You're a dwarf, Stephen.
Apart from that, yeah.
They think they're better than us.
They think they're better than everybody, Michael. Dancing around with their harps and tra-la-la and all this. Let me say, elves. I think I would agree with Jason and stuff, and Rivendell was very slow, but nice for world building, I think. And obviously, essential to the plot. I find there's a lot of, I don't know if it's just this section, but there's a lot of like lucky stuff that happens. Like, you know, pure jamminess, where they find, you know, the swords that happen to tell you if goblins or orcs are nearby. You know, the elves magically know how to, you know, get into the mountain. Obviously, Bilbo finds a ring randomly, which helps him do everything else in the book. You know, there's a lot of lucky things going on, but obviously key plot points, so it's fine. Just thought I would point that out, but yeah.
I think that is, that's definitely something that points to it being a children's book, definitely, yeah. More than Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, it's like they just like luckily get out of things, you know.
Yeah.
There's no... Yeah, another thing that I want to point out is that the dwarves are just useless, man. Everything they do, they either get captured or they like drop Bilbo or, you know, completely useless. They don't do anything. I think that's quite funny. But yeah, I like that. Obviously, yeah, the stuff of Gollum, terrifying. Imagine meeting him in a cave. Yeah. Kill me. Like, kill me immediately. I don't want to talk to him.
So, I think then, I'll say, just to kind of bring up something we haven't spoke, is the, you know, you have the whole riddles in the dark. They do the contest is, you know, Gollum will create a riddle, Bilbo will try and get an answer, and then if he gets an answer, he'll do one. And whoever's first to not be able to give an answer loses. And then Bilbo, you know, obviously just complete cheat here, but, you know, it's yeah. Obviously like, you know, it's obvious that he has to do this, you know, or else they're going to be here all day. More or less just asked straight out, what's in my pocket? And Gollum's like, you know, that's not fair. And then he's like, you have to give us three guesses. And then he guesses three things and can't get it. And so he's like, Bilbo's like, you have to show me the way. And then Gollum's right, to have to get some of my things. So Gollum lives out in like the middle of an island and within this mountain. It's basically like an underground lake, and he lives out in the middle of it. So he's got like a wee boat where he swims out to the island. And so he goes out to the island and realizes his favorite possession, i.e. the ring, is missing. And he's looking all over the place, screaming, where the hell is it and stuff. And then it kind of comes to him, you know, he asks Bilbo, what was in your pocket? So he's kind of like on to him that Bilbo's found this ring. Now, Bilbo doesn't really know the significance of the ring or why Gollum wants it or the power of the ring yet. But basically, there's a kind of chase then where Gollum chases Bilbo, and Bilbo, I can't remember how it happens in the book, but in the movie, like Bilbo falls and the ring slips on his finger, which happens to Frodo as well in the movies, and I just think it's absolutely ridiculous. The accuracy of catching a ring in your finger is just mental.
Magic.
But yeah, I suppose the ring is trying to get onto your finger, you know, the... alert its master of its whereabouts and stuff, so maybe that's it's you know, drawn.
Give itself a wee nudge.
Yeah, give itself a wee nudge, exactly. But yeah, Bilbo discovers that the ring can turn him invisible, so then he knows that Gollum starts speaking to himself, as he often does, and says that he's gonna go to the exit because he thinks that's where Bilbo's heading. And so Bilbo then knows they just follow Gollum and he'll lead him to the exit, like unknowingly. And then, yeah, Bilbo's able to escape. That's kind of the last we see of Gollum in The Hobbit. And we obviously re-encounter him in Lord of the Rings. But yeah, Bilbo gets out, and Gandalf and the dwarves have just already got out here. And they're kind of like, Gandalf noticed Bilbo's missing and was like, where's Bilbo and all? And the dwarves are like, oh, no one's seen him and all. And I think, is it Balin is supposed to be their watch guy who, you know, none gets past them. And then Bilbo's obviously got the ring on, so he does get past and then just takes it off like before they see him. And then he just goes, here I am. And they're all kind of, this is where they first kind of think that maybe Bilbo is the guy, because all the dwarves kind of doubt Bilbo, you know, being a hobbit and being this peaceful being and all. He's not really shown much yet that he's going to be able to complete this task. But the fact that he was able to survive on his own and sneak pat up to them without anybody knowing is kind of like quite impressive. And they're, you know, like, God, maybe this guy is a good burglar and stuff. But yeah, in the next few chapters they uncover the goblins and the wolves. So in Lord of the Rings, a lot of like creatures like wolves, and there's eagles now will show up. They're like they're their own races and they can talk and stuff like that. But the wolves and the goblins kind of team up. They hunt down the party of Bilbo and the dwarves and Gandalf. And essentially, as happens in The Lord of the Rings, Gandalf is able to call the eagles to their rescue. And the eagles, there's obviously the whole like, thing of why the eagles can't just, like, you know, whenever in The Lord of the Rings, fly the ring to Mordor and stuff. It's, but the eagles aren't actually like on anyone's team. They just like help out Gandalf sometimes. Because Gandalf, you know, does favors for them, but they don't like men or whatever. They're not like friends of normal races. They obviously don't like the enemy, but they're also not like on the side of the hobbits or the dwarves or anything like that. But yeah, in this instance, they come to save them and carry them away. And then they get carried to Bjorn's house. So Bjorn is what is known as a skin changer. So he can transform into a bear, and he's also, I think, when he's in a human, like a man form, he's actually like kind of quite large. He's like a giant almost. But yeah, he's like a recluse who kind of lives in the middle of nowhere, and they kind of need refuge in his house from the goblins and the wolves who are hunting them. But because he doesn't really like dwarves or whatever, and I think whenever Gandalf knows who he is, but whenever Gandalf comes back to him, he's like, he kind of doesn't really know Gandalf or anything. And there's this whole stupid part where Gandalf is like, to the dwarves, right, you have to come in twos, because if you're introduced to him all at once, it'll turn us away. But if he's come two by two, I can kind of like, convince him to let us like stay for the night and, you know, feed us and whatever and protect us from the wolves and the goblins. So yeah, what do you think about all this from basically Bilbo showing up to the dwarves after the goblin cave until you know, Bjorn's house and stuff, Michael?
Yeah, it was it starts with a nice moment for Bilbo where he finally gets his due respect, and the dwarves kind of finally see what Gandalf has kind of seen on Bilbo bringing him here. The part in you know, that the wargs and the goblins teaming up, obviously that pays off later in the story in a climactic way. And then Bjorn's house, the moment that you referenced to where Gandalf slowly introduces them and I think Andy Serkis's performance again was very funny, where he was like growling, he's like, oh, that better be it's a kind of an I thought that was very funny, very well done. And again, something I like about these books is that the kind of nuance of characters, different races, and the fact that there isn't like just the good and evil, there's everybody's kind of got their own side and between and their own interests, and the races have their own interests, and it's just a very subtle, clever way of doing world building. It's a very economical way of doing world building. Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit obviously inspired like a slew of epic fantasy books that don't handle world building as skillfully as maybe these books do. It's been a while since I've read Lord of the Rings, but especially The Hobbit does anyway. It's very straightforward and everything, and yeah, really like this section.
Jason?
I liked sort of, maybe not necessarily the character of Bjorn, but I sort of like the actual like shapeshifter and like this big sort of big scary bear type of character. I mean, actually, Bajor himself just seemed like a very crabbit person. You know, he just seems angry at the world.
A pile of dwarves turned up at his door.
I'm sure there's only about five of them turned up. It was all right.
Still.
Shoot them. By the way, I like the big shape-shifting bear man. I don't know if any shapeshifters really show up in future entries in the series, but I think he might have been the last one anyway, so maybe that's why. The sort of scene of Bilbo like sort of finally getting his recognition for being the master burglar is also quite nice amongst the hobbits. Also, they also don't know about the ring yet, but it was nice to see him finally be part of the group, part of the team, sort of pulling his own weight a wee bit. Even though it was sort of pure luck, but it's a children's book. It's going to be pure luck. It's sort of got that Harry Potter syndrome where it's just like, we just need this to happen, so it's just going to happen for Bilbo. It's just going to work out well for him. But it's probably written in a much better way rather than just like he overheard it because he's invisible. But yeah, again, great section. The wargs, the wolves, it was fine. It's still good, but again, doesn't let things lay sort of slow or dormant for too long. Like, even there is that sort of slight little respite from getting out of the cave, but then it's just straight back into the action. And you know, that first sort of instance of the Eagles cheat code coming into play to rescue them. Great section again.
And Stephen.
Okay, first things first, justice for Smeagol or Gollum, because like Bilbo did him dirty twice, right? First he robs him and then he cheats him in the game, right? Justice for Gollum. What else? Yeah, so the whole escape, I think it's really well done. You know, him following Gollum and them, you know, sneaking past the goblins and everything, and then getting back to the dwarves, I think I really like that. What else? Oh my god, I'm drawing a blank. What happens after that? So he goes back to the dwarves, and then...
And they get chased by the wargs.
The goblins and wolves.
Say it again?
The goblins and the wolves chase them, and then Gandalf calls on the eagles, and then takes them to Bjorn's house.
Eagles and Bjorn, yeah, okay. So, yeah, the whole thing about the eagles, and they're kind of doing Gandalf a favour. Again, I think that's all really good world building, and obviously there's sort of a payoff for that in the next book or series of books. You know, obviously the eagles make another appearance, but they're not just a catch-all, you know, win condition where you call the eagles and it's GG. And then the goblins and the wargs, obviously that pays off later, like Michael was saying. Then the stuff of Beorn, I really love the whole Beorn section. Well, you know, it also shows how like crafty Gandalf is again, where you know he knows this guy is a bit of a grump, so he has a whole plan to like trick him basically into letting him stay. I really like that, but I also like that unlike everybody else, he's sort of mean to Gandalf, whereas everybody else does what he says. He's kind of like, no, you do what I say, sort of thing, and I really like that. Because Gandalf gets away with too much, right? But that's something else.
He does, you're right.
I'm just thinking, what's that?
Everybody just bends over for Gandalf, don't they? Yeah.
I know. Easy craft, but I also realized at this part of the book something I said in the last episode. I was talking about Tom Bombadil and how I wasn't looking forward to that. And I realised that I was conflating Tom Bombadil and Beorn as the same character. Right. Because they sort of have the same role. But they're very different characters at the same time. So I think that's what I was talking about.
Right.
I was wondering what you meant earlier, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what happened there. But yeah, Beorn's a great character, I think. And yeah, how he just wants to be left alone. Love that. Good section. I think this might be my favourite bit of the book, you know. The whole from Gollum on to here, basically before they go into the forest, which is about to happen next.
Yeah.
Spoilers.
Bjorn's an interesting character. I do like the whole like fact that he's the skin changer, can turn into this bear. I wish like this came up again in the series. Unfortunately, it doesn't, or definitely not in the trilogy anyway. I'm not sure about the prequel, the other books. But yeah, I think it's quite an interesting power. Like, and especially to especially if you've watched the movie, it makes him like seem this extremely powerful being. But then again, his race has been like, I think he's the last surviving member of his race. They've been like hunted the extinction by, was it like the orcs or the goblins or whoever? But yeah, I think it's definitely an interesting power. I think the Bilbo getting the recognition from dwarves seems to be a lot of the case where they kind of doubt him, and then they like he saves them, and then they're like, oh, Cabades, Bilbo's lethal, and then all of a sudden then a couple of days pass and then they doubt him again. Just this constant cycle of him having to prove himself. I was like, when will it be enough? Yeah, it's just good interesting section. The eagles getting introduced obviously seem like quite powerful beings, but yeah, they're kind of quite mysterious, and again, you don't really see a lot of them throughout the whole series of books. They just kind of show up every now and again. They help Gandalf out of a sticky situation, but no, yeah, that's everything I have to add. So we can kind of move on to the next chunk, and that is, as Stephen said there, when they go to Mirkwood. So Bjorn lends them ponies and the horse for Gandalf, and they make their way to Mirkwood, which is an enchanted forest that essentially they have to travel through. If they were to go round, I think the distance would be too great that they would never make it to their destination in time. So they have no choice but to go through, and here again Gandalf sneaks off. Classic Gandalf. They run, do other things, and of course I'm sure he'll show up just exactly when they need him to show up again in the future. But get Bilbo and the dwarves head into Mirkwood with warnings not to drink or touch the stream of water, of black or dark water, I believe, as it's got like powerful enchantments on it. And Mirkwood, of course, is quite a strange enchanted forest that's like, it's almost very, it's a very trippy kind of place. And you know, it's like Gandalf warns him, don't be getting lost from the path or you'll never find your way back to it. So it's kind of like this illusion almost that's going on throughout this journey through this forest. And within it as well, it's got its own dangers of like its actual physical dangers as well as the psychological ones in the spiders. So there's these giant spiders which attack the group, and Bilbo, this is another chance for him to redeem himself, using the ring, is able to turn invisible, and the rest of the dwarves are caught and like tied up in silk by the spiders, and then Bilbo using the ring kind of saves them. And I think this is where the sword is named. I think it like stabs one of the spiders, and it's when Bilbo has the ring on, they can hear like evil creatures communicating, so the spiders, he can hear what they're saying. And I think one of them says it stings, and then this is like the first time Bilbo's got to properly use the sword, and he decides to name it Sting. But yeah, they kind of fight the spiders, and then Bilbo saves them, and then they kind of get lost. They're lost from the path because of this whole thing, and they're essentially kind of tripping out, losing their minds and stuff in this kind of weird forest setting. And the elves find them and capture the dwarves. Again, Bilbo avoids detection with the ring. The dwarves are taken by the elves to the wood elf kingdom, which is within Mirkwood. Bilbo kind of follows along closely, using the ring to conceal himself, and you know, slips him to the kingdom with them. I believe the elf king gives Thorin like an ultimatum of he wants the wood elves are like interested in this like silver jewel that they have within the, as part of the treasure of the Lonely Mountain where the dwarves are journeying to. And the elf basically wants these jewels, which he believes belong to the elves, returned to him. And Thorin, again, has hatred, the dwarves' hatred for elves. They're very stubborn, and they won't agree to give these jewels back to the elven king. So the elven king locks them up until basically they agree. And Bilbo, using the ring, comes in and is able to set them all free. And I think they escape like three barrels that are used to like transport their wine. And they, so they like the barrels are like sent up and down a river. So the dwarves, or Bilbo conceals the dwarves within barrels and sends them down the river. And yeah, we'll maybe cut there and discuss this whole Mirkwood and introduction to the wood elves kind of stuff. So Michael, do you want to go again first?
Yeah, it feels like a fantasy story is not complete without number one, a creepy forest, and number two, big spiders. And they're both together combined in this section. Mirkwood, the setting, it's, you know, you can tell that Tolkien is tapping into his kind of, his own kind of setting in England. Creepy forest is abound. Yeah, they go into the depths of this, and then we have the capture. Well, we have Bilbo confronting the spiders, which is a moment where he gets to be quite heroic. Even if he does have the advantage of using the ring, he gets to be quite active in this moment. And then the capture of the elves, we get a bit of the bigger Middle Earth history, kind of seeing the race relations between the elves and the dwarves and the kind of strained relationship that they have, which will play a future part in the Lord of the Rings series. Really enjoyed in that part too, getting the guards drunk, having to cart out in the barrels. I thought the image of them going down the river and the barrels, I remember the first time I read that, I just thought that was such a clever way to get out and such a good scene and such good imagery of them just all hurtling down in these barrels. Yeah, I really, really liked this scene too. I thought it was, again, jam-packed with stuff. There's just so much covered in every chapter in this story.
Yeah, again, just great. Just keeps going. Stays at a high level. Mirkwood, quite eerie. Michael's right. Like, it wouldn't be a fantasy book without a creepy forest and big spiders. And yeah, big spiders, I hate them. So they work well to create that sort of tension. For me, definitely. And then once we get to the elves, the section of the elves, and I like how sort of fleshed out it is. Like, I like how Bilbo's in there for quite a long time, and it takes him a long time to actually get like a plan in place to rescue the dwarves. I think the plan is a bit silly, but again, it is a children's book. But actually, I find that image of them like all floating down the river in the barrels to be like very, very iconic. I do like how they escape, but I think when it's first mentioned, I do think it's a bit like, seems like a stupid idea, but it works. Yeah, it's just a great time. It's maybe not, even though I don't personally like the spiders, I don't think it's maybe as much peril as in sort of previous sections with like the trolls and with Gollum and the cave full of goblins, but I still think it's keeps the sort of tension and keeps the pace. Right.
Yeah. Stephen?
Yeah, another mad one. So at the start of this bit, this sort of section, your Gandalf sort of makes it clear that he's not coming back. Well, he might see them at the end, but you'll not see him for ages now. So you're sort of left with the feeling that obviously stuff keeps happening to these dwarves. Something's definitely going to happen when, you know, their savior's gone. So there's that sort of tense atmosphere, at least that's what I thought anyway. First time I read this, then, you know, dwarves being dwarves, they obviously mess it all up, and I think it's Bomber falls into the river and then goes all mad after that. You're captured by the elves. And obviously, as I said before, elves are not nice people. They're badens, right? So obviously they're looking something off the dwarves, because why wouldn't they be? And Thorin, as Johnny was saying, he's like, nah, them's my jewels. Or he didn't even tell him about anything. He's like, I'm not telling you what we're doing. Again, the dwarves are trapped. Love all that. Because it really shows how stubborn the dwarves are. And again, I think it harkens back to that sort of, I don't know if world building's the right way to phrase it, but it sort of, you know, builds the common relationships between elves and dwarves. And you can really feel that in this section of the book, I think. And then Bilbo's plan to escape is terrible, isn't it? Like, but reading that as an adult, I was like, you know, if this was the first time I was reading this, I was like, I would think this would never work. Somebody's definitely going to die in those barrels on the way down. But no, I mean, everything's fine. And yeah, I think that works really well for like a kid's story. But yeah, good section. Spiders though, horrible. Didn't like it.
Yeah.
Didn't like it at all.
Kill all spiders.
Just wanted to just touch on something Stephen brought up there about that, the fact that Gandalf leaves in this segment. That's kind of funny how it's handled too, because it's kind of just waved away. It's Gandalf was off to do something else that isn't a part of this story.
Yeah.
It's a quite unusual way to handle it in like modern fiction now.
Yeah, you would never see that. Like,
no. And it's like, and it is also like is a device that's used a lot in this book, which is like the intrusive narrator, where the narrator himself is like, he calls attention to the audience. He's like, you won't see Gandalf through this story, but so he actually directly addresses the audience. So, you know, you're being told by a narrator, which is, again, is not a common style. Modernly, it's not used as much anymore, but I quite like it in this book. It adds to that kind of big granddaddy Tolkien is just sitting you down by a fire and reading you a good old yarn. You know, it kind of adds to that.
And
just it also that way kinda, in the book, I think.
Kind of builds the intrigue of, like, what is Gandalf away doing? And, like, kind of sets the timeline right, you know, that this is the time that Gandalf was away doing this.
Yeah.
He's a busy guy.
He's got lots of
things to be at.
The parallel thinking that Tolkien had is like, alright, I'll send Gandalf, well, was he writing this first book? I'm like, right, I'll send Gandalf away here and he'll go do something interesting, but I don't know what yet, or had he that already planned? It's like, Gandalf,
I don't think he had anything planned. I don't think it was all planned out. I think he just wrote it as he went along, and he just wanted Gandalf out of the way, because, like I said, the dwarves and Bilbo sort of have to stand on their own at some point.
Yeah, he's a bit OP, like, isn't he?
Because he is like he's the plot armor.
I think I have read that basically what Stephen said, that that The Hobbit was kind of written on its own, and it was only after J.R.R. Tolkien kind of wove it into the Middle-earth kind of tapestry that he kind of tied it together after that, and I did like rewrote like new editions and stuff. So I don't know if he would have had something planned for Gandalf. It probably was just this classic kind of part of fantasy books where the mentor has to either go away for a while or die.
Yeah.
And one other thing I want to just bring up, since you sort of mentioned the narrator, because something we've maybe slated another book for in the past, what was the Journey to the Center of the Earth, and how that was like an older book, and how it was sort of told as like this, the main character like telling a story, and how it sort of took away from some of the tension.
I think I didn't have an issue with that, but I think Stephen had an issue because he said that took away his suspense, yeah. Wasn't it, Stephen?
Yeah, but because in that one it was like it's like one of the characters is telling the story, but then they get into all these like issues where you know they might die or something, but you're like, oh, they're obviously not going to die because he's telling the story. But I think it's different this one. I don't think it's Bilbo.
Yeah, because it's an omniscient narrator here. Yeah. It's like the narrator is basically the eye Tolkien. Of God. He can see anything. Like, yeah.
No, that's fair. I mean, in my head, I did picture it as Bilbo because I know, like, he obviously writes the story in like the lore. He writes his story as like there and back again. You know.
Yeah.
So in my head, it is Bilbo reading the story, but yeah, you're supposed to write like officially. It's probably not him reading it.
Yeah, because the narrator itself gives us like an insight into other characters' heads, which Bilbo wouldn't have known.
I suppose.
Unless you say that Bilbo like interviewed them after and said, what were you thinking at this moment?
Or just like he tells it like as a bit of a dramatized version of events also.
Yeah.
And not like necessarily pure fact.
Classic Bilbo. So then I stabbed the spiders myself. The doors were crap. I did it all.
I mean, the dwarf, he did do everything.
Yeah, Bilbo helps them so much, it makes me think the dwarves need to prove themselves at some stage here. Like, Bilbo should be sitting there doubting the dwarves, and then being like, yeah, like, every time they do something well, he'd be like, oh, you actually are good. I like, be pure condescending. Like, they'd be to him.
Oh, you didn't need me help there? I'll give you.
The dwarves are, like, crusty, and it's with Bart helping him. It's like, what have you done for me lately?
Moving on then, so the dwarves get out of the barrels, quite, I'd say, seasick or whatever, like, you know, they were locked in these barrels. and are kind of, again, when they first get out, they're kind of a bit annoyed with Bilbo almost. He's like, yeah, well, I mean, this is the only way, you know, yous are welcome. But again, they're just a bit of a stubborn kind of breed. They're not, like, they're all, because they're all sick and feeling unwell initially, they're not the most thankful straight away. But I guess that eventually do recognize that Bilbo did help them out of that sticky situation. But they basically make their way to kind of the closest habitation to the Lonely Mountain, which is Lake Town. So it's inhabited by humans, and they get there, and there is a prophecy of the dwarves returning to the mountain to defeat the dragon and whatnot, and, you know, reclaim the wealth. And, you know, the hope is that the people of the town will share in the wealth for helping them and stuff. So they help the dwarves, because the dwarves have had all their possessions and their weapons and stuff taken off them when they were captured by the elves. So the people of Lake Town, you know, resupply them so they can continue their journey, which then takes them up to the Lonely Mountain, which is exactly where they've been traveling to, and contains the dragon and the treasure. And they have to essentially solve this riddle of the map, which is that the door will appear with the last light of Durin's day, and they're looking for the door and get kind of frustrated that they can't find it or whatever, and think they're running out of time, and Bilbo helps solve the issue, which I think is quite a parallel kind of part of the story, that exactly the same thing happens with Frodo, who is Bilbo's nephew in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, where he is the one that discovers how to open the dwarf door. Just kind of funny, it's always a Baggins that figures it out, you know, even though there's dwarves there who should know how to open their own doors, they don't never know how to do it.
Ah, but it was a secret door.
A secret door, ah well. I mean, surely if they're building a door, they should build this so that all the dwarves, but no one else knows about it, not the friggin', just the person that built it knows about it, and that's it. Like, it's a bit stupid. they're very secure and well-designed doors, but they're not very well described in terms of how to actually open them. But yeah, they are able then to get this door opened, and Bilbo is now able to do exactly what they've brought him here for, which is to go in and, I mean, I think in the book it's different. In the movie, I think he's solely going in for the Arkenstone. So the Arkenstone is the crown jewel, or like the most valuable kind of item. It's like an heirloom of the House of Thrain. So, like, this is kind of what they wanted mostly in the movie. But I think in the book, it's like he's going and they get the treasure. I don't really know how, like, they thought that he was going to be able to get all the treasure up. Especially if you've watched the movie, the absolute vast quantity of treasure is shocking. But yeah, I'm not really sure why they were sending them in the first place. I think maybe it was the kind of, because I think the dragon hasn't been seen in like 60 years. So they're kind of like sending him almost in as a scout to check it out. But yeah, I'm maybe you guys can speak to this in your whenever you give your part. But yeah, Bilbo's sent inside, and he is kind of creeping around, and he finds the Arkenstone. But he kind of, without telling anyone, he keeps this under wraps for now. So we'll return to that in a bit. But he also discovers the dragon Smaug. So whenever he takes like a piece of treasure, and like dragons apparently know exactly the amount of treasure that they have. So whenever Bilbo takes one thing, the dragon is able to kind of sense that something's gone missing, and confronts Bilbo. And Bilbo and the dragon converse, and the dragon is aware that the dwarves are about, and is kind of like aware that they've sent Bilbo down here. They do their bidding and all, and kind of telling Bilbo that, you know, he's been sent in this dirty errand by them, like, why aren't they down here themselves, and all, trying to convince Bilbo that the dwarves are actually not great themselves. But yeah, I think Bilbo notices, like, while he's talking to the dragon, he notices a gap in the dragon's, like, armor. So the dragon's armor can't really be penetrated by most things, but there's, like, a legend of somebody from Dale, which is, like, one of the human towns that was destroyed by the dragon, but there's a person there who actually was, you know, fighting the dragon and shot it, and was able to dislodge like a scale from his armor. So this is basically a weak point, and on noticing this vulnerability, I think there's like in the book, there's like the birds are apparently quite, you know, they can speak to birds, And there's like a Frush who overhears this conversation and goes to tell the Lectown resident Bard, who is like an ancestor of this person who wounded the dragon. But yeah, the Smaug kind of realizes that the people of Lectown have helped Bilbo and the dwarves get here. So the dragon goes and wreaks havoc on the town, and Bard shoots an arrow at the dragon and into the chink in the armor and kills him. So yeah, what do you think of this whole section of getting to Lectown and then going up to the Lonely Mountain and Bilbo confronting the dragon?
The Lectown sections aren't my favorite parts in the book, to be honest. They just thought they're fine. The kind of the suspense then of going up to the Lonely Mountain and the meeting of Smaug is a very good moment of the book. Like yourself, Jonathan, I'm not really sure what the logistics were supposed to be of getting all that treasure out or transporting it or anything. But maybe the plan was, as you say, a scout to see if maybe Smaug was gone, and then it would have been an easier case of just making separate trips. Yeah, I thought that was a great meeting, and I thought that was a great part in the movies as well. The movies aren't my favorite, but the depiction of Smaug in the movies I thought was excellent, really well done, and really good performance by Benedict Cumberbatch doing the voice. The Lectown thing as well, then with the Bard and the Frush speaking to him and the arrow, it was all a bit out of left field, but I kind of just bought onto it. But I would say the stuff concerning Lectown's not really my favorite parts of the book. It feels about too random and too out of left field for me. Stretches my incredulity a tiny bit, but yeah, really like Smaug. Really think he's depicted well, and the kind of doing the intelligent dragon while still remaining terrifying obviously harkens back to Beowulf, and Tolkien was obviously a big fan of that story. Quite enjoyed it overall.
I suppose, yeah, Lectown, it's maybe not the most exciting. I've briefly mentioned that I watched the movies, and I'll talk about it a bit later on, but Lectown gets a lot more fleshed out in the movies, whereas it's more of like an afterthought, I would say, in the book. It's more of just we went through here, then we got up to the mountain, and then there's about six chapters in the mountain. But the as soon as they get into the mountain, that's from that moment of Bilbo getting in and stealing a cup of the golden cup, golden chalice, and we meet Smaug for the first time, like that's just the best bit of this book for me. Like, Smaug was such a terrifying character. I think Andy Serkis again does the voice justice, definitely. I find this sort of scene of him and Bilbo chatting to give like more peril than the sort of riddle scene between Bilbo and Gollum. I think this is, for me, I think this is the best scene in the book, just when Bilbo and Smaug are actually just chatting. That's definitely the highlight of the Hobbit for me. In terms of their plan, I do think it's mentioned, again, this might be from the movie, but I do think it's Bilbo gives off at one stage about like what was the plan for me to sort of go in and out like a million times to get every single piece bit by bit. But yeah, great section there as the highlight of the book for me, this sort of scene up in the Lonely Mountain, definitely.
I think he does say that in the book, but it's like glossed over.
I don't know what the plan was, but yeah, I definitely remember Bilbo saying that at some stage.
Stephen?
Yeah, I think I have to agree about Lectown. It's not the best, is it? It definitely feels like it was shoehorned in at the end, as a plot device for two reasons. One, to kill the dragon, because the dwarves were never going to be able to do that, and they had to get rid of it somehow. And two, to like, you know, give sort of more peril at the end with the Battle of the Five Armies, or whatever. Not the battle, but more so the argument over the treasure. So I don't really like the Lectown stuff. The whole bit with Smaug is great. Like, I mean, the guys touched on it perfectly. Like, Smaug's amazing. Definitely tenser than Gollum. Like Jason was saying, with Smaug. I don't know. I have no idea what the dwarves' plan was. It seems a bit foolish. But again, I think that might be something we mentioned earlier, where Tolkien was just writing as he went along. And he kind of got to this point and he's like, oh, crap. What do you... Didn't think this one through. But yeah, I loved it. Not so much the letdown bits, but the bits in the mountain were great. I like that, you know, the dwarves kind of... The dragon sort of attacks him once and then leaves. And then that's it. You know, they escape from harm yet again.
Yeah.
I like that.
I think for me, again, agree with you guys. Like, this is probably the most interesting, best part of the book. The whole confrontation with Smaug. I think, like, going back to the plan, yeah, it seems that Bilbo was kind of just being used as a scapegoat here just to go on and check it out to make sure the dwarves could go on and then do their thing, but they didn't tell Bilbo that. Maybe that was the implication of this. But it's hard to tell what the plan was, or maybe they were just winging it and they didn't even really know what they were going to do when they get there. They kind of didn't really, you know, realize that they would have made it the whole way, maybe.
As the Joker would say, they're a dog chasing cars.
Yeah, they don't know what to do with it if they catch it. Yeah, so it's yeah, but it's definitely a good scene of Bilbo going down. And I think the movie again, the movie flushes Lechtown out a lot, like, more. Like, Lechtown in this is, yeah, very glossed over, and it doesn't really kind of give you the satisfaction that, like, Bard killing the dragon and stuff in this. It's kind of very abrupt. Whereas in the movie, it's this, you know, gives you this whole dramatic back scene of, like, you know, Bard's ancestor, like loosening the dragon scale with the black arrow, and then, you know, everybody now saying that now never, and people don't believe that this is true, and his, like, family name is in disgrace because of it, and then Bard has to, you know, kind of live up to the, or, like, kind of reconcile this feeling of his ancestor. I think it's just a lot better done in the movie, and, like, especially...
Gives you a better sense of his arc, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Bard's a more interesting character, and I think, too, that obviously the head of the town is played by our favourite Stephen Fry, the master of the town, and he's quite a funny character, and, like, you know, the wee sidekick of his, the wee boy, like, the wee kiss arse guy is quite funny and stuff. So Lechtown gets a lot more love, I say, in the movie, and definitely more interesting. As well as the whole part in the mountain with the dragon, you know, the whole conversation with Bilbo. I think the conversation with Bilbo is good in the book as well, but what it doesn't have is the scene in the movie where the dwarves fight the dragon and, you know, their plan is to, like, melt the gold and, like, cover the dragon in gold and stuff. I think that's quite interesting in the movie. Whereas, yeah, in the book, it's kind of like the dragon goes out and, like, kills and eats a couple of their horses and stuff, and that's kind of it. But yeah, I still think the conversation between Bilbo and the dragon's quite interesting in this part. I guess we can kind of move on then to the ending of the book. So with the dragon slain, the mountain is now kind of free, and the treasure within the mountain is highly sought by a lot of people. So that includes the people from Lechtown, the dwarves themselves, but also the elves who want the, you know, the silver gold or whatever, the silver diamonds or whatever there. And then the dwarves are, you know, reluctant to share any of this, even though they kind of promised the people from Lechtown they would give them money. But I think they just get really stubborn and all, and don't, you know, want to just hold on, even though there's absolutely heaps of gold in this mountain. They're like, this is our gold, and they've got this whole pride or stubbornness about them. And everyone's kind of gearing up for war. The men and the elves are kind of marching on the Lonely Mountain to confront the dwarves. So there's only the 13 dwarves on Bilbo in the mountain, but they've got it, like, well fortified, and it's, you know, going to be hard to penetrate by the people. And just kind of whenever it's about to come to blows, Bilbo reveals or sneaks out and gives the Arkenstone to the Elven King, and Bard is, like, the unofficial leader of the men now. So he kind of gives them the Arkenstone, which is the crown jewel, which is kind of what, you know, is most prized and worth, like, I think it's more or less Bilbo's share, which is a 14th of all the gold in the mountain. He kind of saying that's what that was worth, which is a lot of gold. So knowing that Thorin will want this jewel because it's, you know, kind of what will cement his name into being the king of this mountain, Bilbo gives it to them in order for them to be like, right, we'll trade you the stone for the our share that we deserve. This is the for the elves and the men. And Bilbo reveals then that he was the one that gave the Arkenstone away, and Thorin banishes him from the mountain. And then when the dwarves knew that the people were coming to attack the mountain, he sent word to his like relatives with other dwarves, and their army arrives, and everything's about to come to blows when, of course, Gandalf arrives just in the nick of time to tell them that there is an army of goblins and wargs approaching. And then the dwarves, the men, and the elves band together to fight the goblins and the wargs in what's known as the Battle of the Five Armies. And within this battle, Thorin is fatally wounded, and as he's lying on his deathbed, kind of reconciles with Bilbo, and Bilbo kind of agrees, you know, that he did give away his share, but he'll take a small chest of gold, which is more than enough. And to be honest, I don't think Bilbo would have been able to get his share back to the Shire very easily, because it was a lot of gold. And of course, just look at how hard this whole journey was just to get here. Imagine having to lug a big massive lump of gold back with you.
I'm sure he's meant it anyway.
I know. So he just agrees on a small chest, or is it like two small chests or something like that, whatever his pony can muster. And yeah, Thorin dies essentially at the end of this quest, meaning then now that kind of, I think everyone ends up sharing in the golds and stuff. And Bilbo returns home, and, you know, with his gold, he's now a rich guy in the Shire, and he's also forever changed by his experience in this journey. I believe the whole time of the journey was just over a year. So, yeah, that's that kind of brings us to the end. What did you think of the battle and the kind of climax of this book, and how it ends with Thorin dying, of course, being a big thing, and then Bilbo, you know, heading home?
Yeah, so like this part starts with the death of the dragon, which is kind of this embodiment of greed, and then with his death, it's not like greed is defeated. It actually disperses down to the individual clans and races, and it's kind of this squabbling and to Bilbo that may seem pointless. So he gives the Arkenstone to the elves, which I think was a pretty decent solution to get them to compromise, because it seemed like things were just going to escalate if there was no weight behind their leverage. That was the word I was looking for. There was no leverage for the elves to use. And then it comes into the battle itself, which should not have been its entire own movie in the trilogy, but that's...
Yeah, that was called.
That's another conversation, but
we'll wait for that.
My God. But yeah, it was great climactic kind of scene for the adventure to conclude, and a pretty good emotional kind of drawn of the end of the arc then with Thorin recognizing that that he was consumed by greed. And I think I can't remember the exact quote, but he says if more people concerned themselves with like the simple things, or more people were like Bilbo, you know, there wouldn't be all this horribleness in the world. It's a lot more eloquent than what I just described it as being, but he basically has that conversation with Bilbo. So it's a nice kind of satisfying way to round off the story and bring it kind of some thematic resonance to the story. And then Bilbo, you know, he gets his reward. He returns to the Shire with his big thing of gold. And he is obviously very, very wealthy now compared to the rest of his residents. And aren't they like selling off his items and auctioning off when he goes back? But yeah, I thought it was a great ending to the book. It just really brings it all home.
Yeah, the journey home truly happened here, you know. It was kind of like, you know, he went on this mad adventure, got what he was looking, you know, he went on it and the search for this great treasure and came back with it and all. And, you know, it's kind of like a very nice full circle way to end it. I think, yeah, the scene, I forgot to mention, was like whenever he gets home, they're auctioning off, thinking that he's been gone for some amount of time, like a year, they pronounce him dead. So they're all like taking and auctioning off all his belongings, but he comes home anyway with loads of money. So it's not like he can't rebuild. but I think the main treasure is the friends that I made along the way. Would I be right?
I think that's the sort of whole point.
Okay. But I mean, I'm sure the big journey, the chest of gold was pretty nice as well. But
yeah, the real treasure was the chest of gold.
Yeah, Jason,
friends are right. Like, I quite enjoyed Thorin's sort of slow descent into madness and the greed that sort of consumed him with the more with the Arkenstone, but just the general hoard of treasure that I had. I really liked the sort of heel turn where he tries to throw Bilbo off the. Off the cliff, off the rampart, until Gandalf just like, nah, lad, wise up, put him down. The battle itself, I remember it being shorter, and like I remember when I first watched the third film, I was like, how have they made a full movie out of this battle? Because like, I was pretty sure Bilbo was just knocked out like straight away in it, but there's a bit more to the battle than just Bilbo like hitting his head or getting knocked out straight away. I think like a brick hits him or something, doesn't it? But I really enjoyed those scenes. I really say like the highlights probably of this section was like Thorin's descent into madness. I liked Beorn showing up as just a bear and just wrecking everybody. But again, the sort of the cheat codes of the Lord of the Rings universe, the eagles are what show up and win it for everyone yet again. I quite liked the actual ending. Like I actually liked just Bilbo, Gandalf and Beorn just sort of wandering home. I thought that was quite nice, quite enjoyable, definitely. But yeah, just a great ending overall. Great book.
Finally, Stephen.
Yeah, it's good section. I think a lot of it, all the Thorin going mad and the dwarves being like, nah, it's our treasure. I think that it just shows again how stubborn dwarves are. You know, they're like, this is ours, it belongs to us, even though Bilbo and Gandalf basically did the whole journey for them. And then I find it kind of weird that the elves get a stake in it, even though they didn't do anything until after. You know, they're like, guess about that. Don't know. I think I sort of agreed with Thorin at that point. I was like, why should they get anything? They put you in jail a minute ago. But anyway, I think it's very smart from Bilbo to like give the elves the thing that Thorin wants most to sort of, you know, appease him. But again, it's another example of that sort of lucky streak that seems to fall into Bilbo's lap, where, you know, he happens to find the one thing that'll sort everything out. But I mean, yeah, it's good. It's a good way to resolve the tension. Yeah, the battle itself, I was kind of a bit annoyed that didn't go on a bit more. Obviously not a full movie's worth, or a full chapter's worth, but maybe a bit more, and you see, like, a few more scenes of some fights. Maybe see Thorin getting, you know, wounded or something. I don't know. But I think it was fine. And yeah, the journey home, I really like that as well. I think that's a really nice touch. Because again, and the whole stuff about Bilbo saying, you know, I don't even want anything. You know, I don't need any gold. I think it really speaks to the sort of message of the this and the Lord of the Rings, where it's like, you know, it's about adventure and greed is bad.
But do you reckon that's sort of like when your granny's trying to give you like a tenner? You're like, nah, I'm okay. Nah.
I don't need it.
Put it in your pocket as you say it.
So yeah, I really like the end of the book. It's great. Great way to round the whole thing off. And the scene at the auction at the end, amazing. It just shows like how hobbits are, where they're like, oh, he's definitely dead. He's been gone a year. He has to be. There's no way he's alive.
To be honest, it's great. Like, if you hadn't seen someone in a full year, and like obviously with technology and stuff, you can message people. But like, imagine back then, there's no way of finding out. After about a year, you probably assume they're not coming back. Like, I thought it was fair enough. Yeah, I agree with what you said. Nice way to end the book. I think the death of Thorin was kind of like, I really liked that happened. Not that I hated Thorin, I just thought like that the way it was kind of conflicted a lot throughout this book, and you know, he had this greed and hunger to reclaim this mountain and the treasure, and then yeah, I think they don't refer to it in the book, but in the movie it's called Dragon Sickness, where you just have this greed and want for gold, but like there's no amount will ever be enough. I think the only release from that would have been death. So Obviously, yeah. I thought this was a good kind of climax for his character. And obviously, the reconciling with Bilbo and stuff after, you know, he kind of realized that, you know, Bilbo is just a good person. Like, it's that he was wrong about him, and he knew that what Thorin, the way he's treated him, has been wrong. And that Bilbo is just like a model character. But yeah, I gain like the funniness too of the whole auction bit. And the, I think Jason said there, you know, the scene where I think Gandalf and Bjorn and Bilbo just head back home, because I was always thinking, like, does Bilbo just head back home now himself? Like, how the hell is he going to get back? Like, he's freaking no chance he's going to survive.
Bilbo, off you go.
I know. But yeah, it just seemed like it was, you know, there was none of the dangers. I suppose they just defeated a large army of goblins and wargs, so the most of the dangers had been destroyed for now. I think that's everything for our review. So, does anyone have any final points or anything?
I just think the whole thing with Thorin's like greed, it obviously doesn't come in in this book, and it was definitely like a retcon. We know when he wrote Lord of the Rings, but I think the greed thing is a result of the, you know, the dwarf rings they get from Sauron.
Yeah,
but that's their thing. So yeah, I like how that ties in eventually.
No, yeah, I think the tie-ins from this book are just, especially the movie, obviously being made after they knew about Lord of the Rings, was done with a lot of like tie-ins and stuff that were foreshadowing. But of course,
they mocked it a lot, though, didn't they?
Like, yeah, of course, yeah. We'll get onto that in a minute, I guess, when we talk about the movie and stuff. But, yeah, we'll move on to our star ratings. So, I've been going to you first, Michael, so let's hear it.
Yeah, I think I pretty much indicated what I was going to give this book last episode when you picked it. I think this is the best book that we have covered. I think it is one of the best books of all time. I think if it is not on the top 10 list of, you know, anybody doing an independent list in a, like, literary magazines or anything, you're wrong. It has to be in the top 10 books of all time, in my opinion. It's Andy Serkis, his performance in this book is absolutely incredible, just elevates it completely. So, yeah, I 100% am giving this 5 stars. I think it's the best book we've done on the show yet.
Yeah, I think I would echo a lot of stuff Michael said, but I don't think it's the best book we've read for me. It's definitely up there. I won't say it's, you know, it's not. But I don't think I would give it a 5. I think I'll go 4.5. Maybe there was, like I said, there's a few bits I didn't like with the singing, the elves, and some of the way they got out of danger kind of in the back of my mind annoys me a wee bit. But at the same time, it's classic. Love it. So I think I'm going to go 4.5. It may be even a wee bit higher, but I don't think we do that. So
yeah. So for myself, I picked this book. Absolutely love anything they do with this whole Middle-earth universe and Tolkien. Just thought this is a great story from start to finish. Even the gripe that I normally have about singing, I didn't think was too bad in this. The singing was grand, I guess. That's probably a testament to Andy Serkis's performance. And yeah, as a narrator, he was brilliant, especially, of course, doing his signature character of Gollum. But yeah, I think he captured Bilbo and Gandalf and the dwarves very well as in this also. Yeah, I absolutely love this book. It's the second time I've listened to it now, and I probably will actually get the physical copy at some stage, just because it's just one of them books, you know, I think everyone should have within their on their bookshelf.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I am giving this a 5 out of 5.
Nice. I never even talked about Andy Serkis, I don't think, when I reviewed, but I mean, he's incredible. Like, I wish he would do more books.
Yeah. This is definitely, I think when we did the Treasure Island, I said books I want to read, like Jonah or my children now, it'll be plural now since then. But but yeah, this would also be in that category of books that I want to show them.
And Jason?
I absolutely loved this book. I made it clear when it was announced, my feelings for this book. I think I said it was my favorite sort of actual, like, physical book I've ever read. In fairness, I not make myself out to be someone who has read hundreds upon hundreds of physical books, but this was definitely my favorite. I have, if everyone ever asked me what my favorite sort of book was, I would have answered The Hobbit. But this is my first time in listening to it, Andy Serkis narrating. I have listened to the three Lord of the Rings books already with Andy Serkis narrating. But this is actually a first for me on the podcast in almost a year. I just realized this is my 12th episode. Right. In almost a year of this podcast, this will be my first 5 out of 5.
Nice one.
Absolutely loved it. Jonathan horned himself out for high marks.
Yeah, that will not be beat.
Let's just say that since Jason has joined, this is now the highest rated book. Obviously, the humans all got fives, but Jason wasn't here. This is now 4.875 average, and the only way it can be beat. The only way it can be beat is if all of us give us five. All of us give it five. Which all I'm saying is, Stephen's only gave 1.5 out of all the books. No, he's give 2 actually.
What was the second one? The humans or what else?
Gate to the Galaxy.
Alright.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
To be fair, I've given 4 fives, so yeah, I'm not too. Michael gives 5s like freaking Christmas cards, so.
Michael's too generous Michael's, at times. Jesus.
I just like books, Stephen. I
just likes number 5.
I'm just a positive
Michael's
person.
Michael's give more 5s than he's not giving 5s. Like.
So yeah, this I'll take the trophy for best book of the year again. Thank you.
No.
You're just.
No trophy.
We knew you as soon as you picked it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like I said, whoever wins the best book, remember, the others have to come together and buy them that book. And I said I would like a copy of The Hobbit on my bookshelf. So I'll take my copy of The Hobbit whenever you all get together.
It's a good one to have. It's good we can get you a nice one.
Nice wee. Just be sitting very nice on my bookshelf, like I just think. Mm-hmm. Right. Moving on to comparisons to other media, we've of course spoke a lot about this. Michael, you mentioned a lot of inspiration for J.R.R. Tolkien was like Norse mythology, likes of Beowulf and stuff.
Yeah,
obviously this itself inspires a lot of future things. Of course, there was 3 movies made. Absolutely madness if you ever see the size of the Hobbit book, how they made 3 movies of this, but then the books or the movies are flushed out like hell with stuff about, like, you know, foreshadowing for the Lord of the Rings, so there's, you know, the same...
They take a lot of stuff from, like, his expanded...
Yeah, exactly.
Like, the whole stuff about the necromancer and all that doesn't... It's touched on in the book, but it actually happens in, like, whatever, you know, has other things that he does.
I really like the stuff with the necromancer.
Like we said in those
the necromancer in the movie and stuff. Like, I think it is kind of quite interesting. Obviously, this is kind of where Sauron's, you know, kind of coming back to power and stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, did we all watch the movies?
I watched the first two.
Not for this show, but I've seen them all.
But I've seen them. I've seen the third one too.
Right. Has anyone watched them for the show or since they've read the
book?
Yeah,
I watched the first two and was halfway through the third one. Unfortunately, I didn't get it finished in time.
Not fair. Stephen, did you watch
them? I wanted to, but she wouldn't do it with me. She wanted to watch something else.
No.
It was too long.
Are we talking about the movies now then? Yeah.
Well, yeah, we're on the comparison they made, Alex. Yeah.
Comparisons, yeah. I would like to just start off by saying that I've only seen all the movies once before, and I had always liked the first two, and then think the third one was just a waste of time. But I'm here. I'm a Hobbit trilogy apologist now. I would say 10 years later, I think I had a lot of issues with the CGI and effects the first time round, and the fact that they made a full film out of a war that was barely mentioned. It was like half a chapter.
Yeah, most of it skipped over, like the fight.
But I really liked all 3 movies. I really, actually, really enjoyed the third movie, even though like a lot of it is, yeah, like it's just sort of made up for the purpose of the film. I actually had a good time. So that's, I just wanted to put that out there. I'm now a Hobbit trilogy apologist because I would have spent the last 10 years slagging it off. Saying it was wasn't worth anything, should have made it 2 films at most. But that, I've had a change of tune.
That is interesting because I am like I haven't watched them since basically the last time I saw these movies were in cinema. I've quite a fondness for that because like the Desolation of Smaug was the first movie that Greta and I went to see together. It was our first date. Now we have one child and another child on the way, so all these years later. Yeah, so I have a fondness that way, but I still think I need to revisit them after you saying that, Jason. I would feel like I will probably give them a rewatch on top of that, but
easy five.
Still feel like it's a massive, massive cash grab, and that this should have been that this could have really made one special movie. There was absolutely no need for this to be expanded the way it was. It could have been a classic 3-hour movie, just one movie that would have been great, but they just fucking. Sorry to swear,
I think two movies would have been fair enough originally. I think one movie still might have been a bit rushed, even though it is a small book.
If they had just stuck to the book,
I think one movie would have been fair.
Yeah, but I think it was too much for one. There was too many wee small things for one, yeah.
Because they also are, as we say, like they're bringing in the whole side plots from different media. Like the whole necromancer thing and like the whole love story between Killy and the elf.
Toriel. Legolas is there for some reason.
I think Legolas being there is fair enough because he would have been there.
Yeah, I know, but he got too much screen time because it's Orlando Bloom, yeah.
I didn't hate it the second time round.
Wasn't there a wee shout out to Gimli? Was like in the movie there's like obviously Gimli and Legolas become good friends. I think in one of the Hobbits of the 13 is Gimli's father, Gloin, is it? And he has like a picture of like Gimli and like Legolas comments being like, what the hell is that creature? He's like, that's my wee lad, Gimli. And he's like, that's more or less, that's rotten looking.
That's my wee lad.
Yeah, but obviously the movies followed out because there's the two extra stories is the Necromancer, which of course is all based about Sauron and like a kind of foreshadow, but you've also got the whole Azog the Defiler, which you know this I thought was a good addition, the whole Azog stuff, because it's like this revenge story as well. Like it's not like they're just going out to kind of defeat this dragon, but this orc is also hunting them, who is the one that killed Thorin's grandfather and stuff like that. You don't get any of that in the book.
Yeah,
he's mentioned in the book though.
Yeah, I think like it's not, but it's offhand. Not like they're like being hunted down by these orcs and stuff. But I think a lot of the screen time goes to them. Jason, you mentioned there about the CGA. Like I watched this back and I still enjoy the movie, but geez, the CGA and all is dodgy as hell. Like,
and it's the fact that like the orcs and Lord of the Rings too. They're partially practical effects and partially CGI, which gives it such a good sense of physicality. Which is just completely missing, I think, in The Hobbit. It just feels so sanitized.
That was one of my major gripes, was the fact that they changed them, like especially like the tomb, like Azog was completely CGI. I don't know. Yeah. I think because I had so long to accept that, and like on my rewatch this time, I was okay with it because I knew it was there. I was like, I'm happy enough to just go with that because I know it's coming.
Yeah, it just felt a bit lazy to me, like, it's, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. Yeah, I've completely changed my tune on the three films. There was something else I was going to say, but it's gone out of my head now, so.
There's a scene in the movie where, just before the trolls, you know whenever the trolls take the horses, and there's, like, the backdrop of, like, that scene is, like, some of the horses, but none of them are moving, they're clearly fake, and the trees are clearly, like, cardboard cutouts and all, and I'm like, this is such a massive movie to be doing something like this. Like, why is this? Like, it looks...
That would never happen in Lord of the Rings. Like, there was so much attention to detail like, in those movies.
It's like this was kind of... It felt a bit rushed. Like, so in terms of, like, the story and all, it was brilliant. And, like, the add-ons, I think, were good. But the actual movie, the cinema stuff, was just rushed. And it was just, pure money grab. Like, there was
He got the budget for one film, but he had
exactly. That's what it felt like.
I have said that, I think, Smaug was incredibly well done in the movies, and I think probably I would even go as far to say probably, well, again, I haven't seen the movies in 10 years, but probably the best dragon ever depicted in a movie or TV show. I thought it was just remarkable the way they brought
dragons.
Aragorn.
I was thinking Aragorn as well, but I don't know, hey.
Aragorn.
Well, Game of Thrones.
I would put him above them, yeah.
He's a talking dragon as well, to be fair. That's like
what are we talking about in characterization or how they look or
just a more breathtaking spectacle of Seeing a Dragon.
Yeah, I don't know. I actually don't know, I haven't seen it in years either, so I don't know.
Yeah, but I guess we've kind of summed up a lot about the movie and stuff. Is there any other comparisons any of you want to make? I think, so just to bring this up before, you can maybe discuss, is the games, which Jason mentioned we played like hell back in the day. And I remember the games just being amazing. Like the Two Towers was, and the Return of the King games especially, was like, it was a big co-op kind of thing. You know, this is before, this is years ago when freaking internet was, you know, not really, like online gaming wasn't a big thing. You know, you've just kind of, if you're playing two player, it was like split screen, but we just really loved them. And there was that game, Michael, we used to play, the Third Age. Remember?
Third Age is good, yeah.
Yeah, it was like
Third Age, remember that?
Yeah, it was like, a turn-based.
I remember one night where I think it was like maybe the four of us and Golly, and like we were fighting the Witch King for hours.
Yeah.
And it was like bugged out or something.
There's like other Battle for Middle-earth games as well, or like real-time strategy ones that I've played as well.
Do you guys remember the big twist in Third Age and the story mode?
Where they caused the goblins or something in the Moria?
The main character who you play as, this is spoilers for anybody for this very old game.
For a 15-year-old game.
Yeah, the main character you play as is the Witch King's son.
No, I don't remember that at all.
No idea.
That's like the big twist in the game.
I think that game came out when I was still not very good at single player games, so I don't think I ever got any further past the Moria.
Yeah. Oh, that was a hard time in the game, fighting the Balrog.
Yeah.
That took ages.
You can always be the bad guy as well, innit? Like you can like play as like the bad campaign, and you could be the Balrog and just absolutely wreak havoc. And I remember like the very last the very last missions, like that fighting Sauron, but as like an eye. So all you do when you're Sauron is you just like explode damage and just kill them all like instantly. It's stupid, but it was fun.
You know what I learned from reading these books, or this one, is that goblins and orcs are the same thing. I found that very interesting. Did you know that?
Does it say that?
Goblins and orcs are the same thing.
They're like the same kind of like genus
or
whatever.
It's just a translation thing.
But like, a smaller... Because goblins are like the one, they like prefer living like underground and they're better climbers and all that kind of stuff. Whereas orcs are more warrior based and like larger.
Yeah, but they're like the same species, you know. Sure, that was interesting. Did not know that.
I
don't know where like orcs and all come from, because like obviously in the like you get like the orcs kind of seem to be like grown out of the ground, but like
they're
corrupted elves.
Yeah, but does that just mean it's like an elf that they've captured and like turned into one, or like how can there be so many orcs? Do you know what I mean?
Like, well, if you think about like if you take another example, like Smeagol is Hobbit, right? Sort of like that.
But where are they getting all these elves from? Like you know, like they're building all these armies. Like say, like they, like Saruman builds an army of 10,000 Uruk-hai or whatever. Where the hell is he getting 10,000 elves from without anyone noticing?
Elf slaughter. Don't know. Maybe he can do it from corpses or something. I don't know.
There's probably people listening to this screaming right now. Like, you fools! How do you not
come
know?
On, you guys?
Why? Because you not know the lore.
You can't. How do you not know the lore?
We'll know it by the time we do Lord of the Rings. We'll figure out what the hell has happened.
Probably should look these things up.
The thing is, though, I joke about it, right? But I am absolutely one of those guys.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like you only need a little piece of an elf, so like one hair from an elf will get you one orc. So then, if you kill one elf, you can get like 1,000 orcs from his hair.
I think we're just making it worse by guessing and speculating.
I think that's the way that works. That's the only way science makes sense.
Oh yeah, science. Yeah,
science. Fantasy science.
Fantasy science.
I think you can do whatever you want, but once you create rules, you have to stick by them. Like,
right. I've just had a quick Google.
Oh,
okay.
Apparently, the change of elf to orc is explained in the Silmarillion.
Silmarillion,
which slightly brings me into what I've been consuming. I'm just going to skip ahead a wee bit.
Yeah.
Have started it.
Oh,
I have.
Well,
and
hold on.
It's narrated by Andy Serkis.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's tough going, I'm not lying.
You're going to be like Thor at the end, all mad, no?
What do you guys think then? We do our Harry Potter book every... Well, it's going to land on November now, so we're doing a Harry Potter every the for the 1st of November. What do you guys think about our May episode then, being the following the Lord of the Rings series, 1st of May every year?
The next being 1, 2, 3, and then going back to the older ones then?
Yeah, doing the Fellowship next, and then...
If you want to recommend it, go for it.
Okay. No, but I'm saying, do you want to open it as a series the way we do with Harry Potter?
If you want to recommend it, nah, if you want to, I don't mind.
That sounds good.
Oh, so what do you guys think? Like?
Yeah, it's just so you don't have to...
Realistically, we're going to pick them eventually.
So you don't have to, like, use your Harry Potter for it, like, so you may as well add them.
And sure. I already own them all, so see, this is a token.
JR token? Yeah. Okay.
But not all of us own the Andy Serkis ones, though, you see.
Well, listen. Not all of us are losers.
I do. I'm just saying. Michael might have the old ones.
I have both.
They're all on Spotify. If you have Spotify Premium, you can get the Andy Serkis ones for free. So, okay, we're moving on. We've compared a lot of media there. By that I mean we've compared it to its own media. We haven't compared it to anything external.
Just pick any fantasy story that's been written since, which is like most of them, right?
Anything where there's magic rings and there's lords of these rings.
Or dragons or orcs. Any mention of an orc is
from yes, here. Anything.
Etc.
Okay, moving on to trivia. I've got a few trivias that I can share. So, the origin of the Hobbit, or its inspiration for Tolkien, was that he used to tell his children bedtime stories. So, what I'm wondering is, one day he's telling this story and goes, Jesus, I might just create a whole world about this and devote my life's work to it. Like, how do you go from just telling your Wayans bedtime stories to that? Like, I don't know, but it's quite interesting that that's how he started. It's like, he just started like creating these little stories to his children, and he must have just gone, this is actually quite good stuff here I've got going.
Should write some of this down.
Yeah.
I remember reading a story that I think he used to be a lecturer, and he was like somebody, he was marking exams or something, and he randomly wrote on one of them, in a hole somewhere there lived a hobbit.
In a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit, which is the first line of this book.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
That's that'd be a deer pipper now, I'd say. It's probably in a museum somewhere.
Oh, fortune,
Yeah, so he wrote the manuscript based off that line, kind of that was a starting point, and then passed it on to some friends. One of these friends included a person called C.S. Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that guy might have wrote some fantasy books we might get to someday as well.
Wasn't there like a funny story? It isn't about The Hobbit, but between those two, Tolkien wrote Treebeard based on him.
I have never heard that, no.
C.S. Lewis didn't like it.
Right, that's funny.
It's funny, because you know he's supposed to be really boring and all. That's quite funny.
Yeah.
So, another bit of trivia is, we did mention about the kind of tying things together was... that The Hobbit was, you know, he heavily revised The Hobbit, especially the whole Bilbo and Gollum scene. They align better with Lord of the Rings. So there was actually a second edition of The Hobbit released in 1951. So I think that's around the same time as The Lord of the Rings. So that also kind of tied more with the ring and stuff. As well, we have this thing that is known about, I think, Lord of the Rings, the movies, is that no female character speaks to each other in the Lord of the Rings movies. In this, there's actually no female characters at all. In The Hobbit, there is one mention of Bilbo's mother, Belladonna Took, but that's the only mention of a woman. There's no female characters.
Yeah.
I think that's madness.
Like, what about the horses? Hmm?
That's how do you write a full story? Like, that means there's, like, obviously... there's no like love interest or anything. Like, they add that in the movie, of course, because it's Hollywoodized. But like, there's like nothing to do with that in this movie. Like, he just kept that out, I guess, because again, this came from his bedtime stories for children. But yeah, I just think that's crazy. Like, that there's not a single female character.
That doesn't pass the Bechdel test.
You would definitely get called out for that.
There's not even a woman to pass take the Bechdel test, Michael.
Yeah. No, sorry, I meant the Lord of the Rings as well.
All right, yeah. But the person who made that test, not quite, and say it was a load of shite anyways.
Yeah, I'll say this about the Bechdel test. It's not very fair if the main character is a man, because a lot of like interaction is with the main character. So like you can't you don't really have many sub characters talking to each other in some books. So I think it has a bit of a load of shit. Like,
and finally, my last bit of trivia is that the Bag End, i.e. Bilbo's home, was inspired by the name of his of J.R. Tolkien's aunt's farm. It was also called Bag End.
Oh, that's good.
So that's me. Any other trivia from you guys?
None for me.
Tolkien, obviously, I think it's very famously known that he kind of created his own language and his own runes for Middle-earth, and he was kind of in the process of doing that when he was working on The Hobbit. He famously, a lot of people would know this too, that he spent decades world-building Middle-earth, but it wasn't like the way sometimes I thought it was done before I looked into it was that he spent the 20 years, then he wrote The Hobbit, then he wrote Lord of the Rings, but it wasn't done as linearly as that. It was in the process of happening. Then he wrote The Hobbit. Then he tied stuff of that into The Hobbit more. Then he wrote Lord of the Rings, and then he kind of developed The Hobbit more based off writing Lord of the Rings, as you say, went back and rewrote. So it wasn't like, wasn't this grand plan. It happened more, you know, he pieced it more together. So it was more organically grown rather than just planned out one day. And then he's like, I'm going to spend the next 20 years on this. Kind of, it was a thing that was built more than a thing that was planned.
If nothing else, I will move on to comparisons to all, or comparisons, so cut that out. I will move on to what else are we consuming. Michael, let's go to you first again.
Not much, to be honest, but I will talk about a book that I was talking to you guys on the group chat. I looked on a Reddit thread. It was like, what are the most disturbing books ever written? Our very own Blood Meridian was the second top comment. The first top comment was a book that I read called American Psycho. I listened to the audiobook of this book, and I can 100% attest to the fact that it is extremely disturbing. I swear it was affecting my sanity. I was like thinking in Patrick Bateman's voice, or at least the way the narrator was doing it for a while. And it is an experience. It's extremely, extremely graphic, extremely gratuitous. I don't know if I can say I had fun with it, but it was definitely an impactful experience. I don't know if I can ever like cover it with you guys, because I don't know if I want to make you guys listen to or read it. It is disgusting. It is a disgusting book, but it kind of...
I'm here for it.
It's kind of making that point of like yuppie culture and 80s excess and stuff like that.
Just Wall Street bros being bros, Michael.
Yeah.
Just cocaine, right?
Maybe bro.
Just one hell of a drug. It's a wild movie,
I'll just say there's a very... Well, the movie is... The movie is tame compared to the book. There's a very interesting scene with a rat, which is going to stay with me for a long time. But apart from that, not been that much.
I mean, as someone who's actually not seen the movie or read the book, how do you rate Christian Bale's performance as Patrick Bateman compared to the book character?
I would say... Like, how accurate is it, or just how good of a performance is it?
Just how good compared to maybe what you had in your mind from listening to the book, you know?
I would say it's an excellent performance. I would say it's a bit, it feels a bit of a different character in the book. You know how when you watch a movie and then you read a book and you're visualizing the characters? I didn't do that that much with the book. I wasn't seeing Christian Bale, so it kind of indicates to me that there is a difference between the characters, the fact that I was able to kind of separate them apart. I'm trying to think what the differences would actually be.
Does the book reference like the whole Phil Collins thing?
Yeah, the book has entire chapters about the music monologues.
That's brilliant. I love that. The music monologues are absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and they always happen after the like murders and stuff. So yeah, they're really good. And the audiobook was brilliant. The guy who narrates it he sounds exactly like a Wall Street bro. And there's like these little inflections and these little pauses he does before he delivers lines, which is just, you know, such a good performance, but I could not get his voice out of my head for a long time.
The Lover's Lines. Give it a read, then. I absolutely love the movie. So, Jason, what about you? What else are you consuming?
I've been on just a big like TV and movie binge recently. Maybe not listen to as much like audiobooks. As I sort of mentioned, I have just started the Silmarillion. Firstly, I'd like to apologize because I feel like I've mentioned that book before and absolutely butchered the name, which I now know is now the Silmarillion. That it's a lot more difficult to get into than The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. It sort of spans hundreds of years with lots of different characters. It's a lot more going on. But it is read by Andy Serkis and, you know, performed beautifully, as always.
How long is that?
It's about 15, no, actually it's about 18 hours, actually, I'm a liar.
I'm surprised by that, you know. I thought it was going to be way longer, based on what I've heard.
It's just, there's a lot going on in terms of what else, like, just to say, a lot of movies. The Hobbit trilogy, I've watched Poor Things, I've watched The Iron Claw, I've almost finished The Wire, finally. I feel like I've been watching that for ages. About 5 or 6 episodes left. It's a really good TV show. I would highly recommend The Iron Claw, especially for people who like wrestling, but I think just in general, it's just a good movie.
Oh, is that the one with Zac Efron?
Yeah, it's really good.
Right, okay.
I was sort of chatting to you just before it. You know, I sort of mentioned it to you because you were off to doing your other podcast with like the Oscar nominees, and I said I'd watched that in Poor Things, and I think that was actually robbed of a Best Picture nomination. I think it's very good.
Yeah, because I'm surprised something like that wouldn't have got over like Barbie, which is more of a like genre movie.
Yeah, I think Barbie's there just because of, well, like how impactful, like not just how much money it made more than anything. Probably it's a good film, but I don't think
it's just not the personally, it's just I don't not think the
it's a Best Picture nominee.
Type. Yeah, it's not the type of movie that Academy.
Was it good?
It's an enjoyable movie, but it's more like something like Elf. You know, it's a more of a fantasy kind of. You wouldn't see like Elf getting nominated for Best Picture. You know, it's weird.
It is a good film. I really enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it too.
It's
yeah,
just not a Best Picture nominee.
No, it isn't.
Not when you see what else is competing with. Like, you know, it's just a completely different genre of film.
Yeah,
that's me. Really?
Stephen?
Yeah, I've not been consuming much. I between this episode and the last one, I went to Disneyland, so that ate up some of my time. I was consuming a lot of Disney stuff. I met Goofy. He's pretty good. He's my favourite. What else? Been watching a lot of Naruto, Shippuden. That's about it, really. Nothing major. I actually started I read another book, but I don't want to talk about it because Jason's going to recommend it. So,
yeah, I've sort of let slip already what I'm going to recommend.
Did you?
We'll talk about that
anyway. Soon. Yeah, we'll move on to that in a minute. For myself, I have been just Diablo 4, if anyone knows the Diablo games, just came out in the Xbox Game Pass. I've been playing that a bit. It's a good game. I've never actually played any of the other ones, but yeah, I've been playing that for a bit. It got a lot of hype when it first came out. It is kind of just you just click on things and things get killed, and yeah, it's just very, it is a like big fantasy kind of thing, series in the gaming world. I'm playing a bit of that. I'm still reading, unfortunately, my thing where I've been trying to read a physical book kind of got stalled last month, so kind of made little progress on my next book, which I said was Atomic Habits, but I didn't actually end up starting that one. I started a different one called Deep Thinking, which is written by Garry Kasparov. For those who don't know, he was probably one of the best chess masters that ever lived. He for about a period of 20 years, he was considered the world number one. And he famously took on the first proper chess-playing computer, or AI, called Deep Blue, and I think built by IBM, and it was the first chess playing computer they beat, like a grandmaster like this. It was highly publicized, but this book basically covers what Gary thinks about AI and the future with AI, and it's actually quite a positive book. Like, you know, he talks about a lot of, you know, people are always concerned about AI stealing people's jobs and stuff like that. And he says, but that's always been the case, you know, when the production line came along, you know, that obviously rendered a lot of jobs redundant, but it creates a lot of new opportunities, or allows people to move on to other things. So he talks like quite highly about it. He also, like, you know, I think he gives one example is, you know, there used to be like something like 100,000 elevator operators or something like that in like the state of New York or something like that, or maybe in America in total or something like that. But he basically says there's this large amount of elevator operators in like the 1920s, and then 30 years later there was none because the elevators became completely atomic or completely automated. So like, he was like, well, you know, they were all going mad about that, but then, you know, you need people to fix the elevators, you need other jobs that's, you know, can come out of things like this. So he kind of like gives his opinion of it being a good thing for humanity and says that, you know, we've always go through this cycle of creating something to do some job and replacing a lot of people, but then that affords opportunities for people to move on to other things and maybe better educate themselves on things and stuff like that. So, yeah, quite an interesting book. I've only read the first couple of chapters so far, but I'm working through that now this month, so I'm looking to get back on track. So March has basically been a write-off for my month. I might try and make up what should be 12 full books by the end of the year. I might try and make that up at some stage. Maybe get a smaller book to kind of catch up. But, yeah, that's kind of my main things at the minute. In terms of my coding work, I've been working on a new project myself and writing like a text editor, but that's specific for the programming language I use, Q. I'm hoping they write something that's kind of, you know, like there's this like program called Vim or like Emacs and stuff on like Linux-based computers mostly. You get them on Windows as well, but it's like mostly like from a terminal kind of doing editing on like text files or source files of code and stuff. And you basically, like in the olden days, this is before like the mouse existed, you had to do all the keyboard shortcuts and all. Looking to write something like that, that's just kind of an interesting thing. But yeah, mainly I've been working on that as well. And I hope they make that like an open source thing as well eventually, whenever I've tidied everything up. But yeah, I'll hopefully be releasing stuff about that on my YouTube channel as well.
It's funny how much we talked about AI at like the initial episodes of this show, and then never really brought it up again. It's just, it's because it went away, wasn't it? It just completely vanished, and there's no more AI.
The fad's over.
What's actually happened, obviously, is, you know, it's just become now, like, you kind of, like, people are expecting now in our industry, especially, like, I use, like I mentioned, that program I'm working on. I'm writing that in C. Now I wouldn't be as proficient in C as I am in, like, in the Q language and stuff, so, like, I would still need, like, a bit of help on it in terms of, like, Google and things. But I use that AI as like, you know, write me a function that can do this, like this primitive thing in the language. You know, I want to be thinking like a higher level, like how this text editor works. But if I need to like say do something very basic low level, it's like, you know, print some characters to the screen, I can just say the thing, they write me a function that does that. So I don't really have to worry about writing that myself. So it is like a tool that you can use. I think even in that book, Garry Kasparov describes the best thing whenever the Deep Blue computer beat him at chess, then he was like saying what the best combination was. He said it wouldn't have been then a machine. The best combination was a machine and a human, because you get the pure brute force number crunching of the machine, but you also get the creativity and the problem solving of the human. So he said the best then team is actually a human paired with a machine, which basically is more or less like a part of modern online chess, because that's what people can do. You can obviously have like a chess solver open on one screen and have your game of chess in another. But if both people have the chess solver, then again it just comes down to who's got the best human creativity. So it's kind of all's fair again. But yeah, that's what I believe with the AI currently in its state at the minute. It's just, I don't know if it will ever get to a state in our lifetime anywhere where it's going to replace like or become better than us. I just think it's going to be embedded in us eventually. I think, you know, they'll just have it implanted in your head. And like we've said before, I think we mentioned that in the last one, is like, you already are kind of embedded with a machine. Everyone has a phone, definitely in the Western world. Everyone has this phone, which is basically like, you can just go on straight away and Google any question, any answer you need, you can Google it. I think these new AI tools are just a better way of doing that. And eventually, I just think everyone will have that in their head. And you won't even need to type anything. You can just think, I want the answer of this, and you'll just know it. Like, I think it's going to be a compliment to humanity as opposed to replacing.
I am optimistic about it in some ways. Like, I've done a lot of research on it since we last really spoke about it in depth, and it's like, I know how it's been used to, like, go trawl through data to, like, come up with, like, new medications, which is obviously going to be a massive... And that's all, there's already, like, we're already experiencing exponential growth and medicine that's meant to be, like, the next boom in industry within, you know, the next 10, 20 years is what they reckon. So obviously it's going to bring a lot of life-changing innovations there. Then we have, like, Sam Altman, like, the CEO of, like, ChatGPT. He's saying how he wants the world to invest trillions in infrastructure, because right now... I think everybody was scared at the start because we recognize the fact that it's the beginning of something and we're like in an exponential growth phase. So we know that society is going to change in a big way, but we don't know how. And so it was just very scary when this technology was introduced, because it was kind of crazy. It seems that it's not exactly as simple as it just having this limitless growth, because we presently don't have the infrastructure to accommodate it. There's, like, a lot that needs to be done to allow it to grow like that. So it's like, say, we have this thing that's growing very, very quickly, but we still have a limited field for those plants to grow, kind of, is the way I think about it. And I'm still wary. It's not exactly that I think AI is going to become sentient and kill us. It's how I think that humans are going to misuse AI. And I think I talked before, like, how... So people have been using it to, like, stalk people and, like, find the real identities of, like, porn stars and things like that. And I don't trust humans. It's not that I don't trust AI.
You know who didn't like AI? And also computers and all of everything else? Tolkien. He warned us with these books, guys. Industry's bad. I can't believe you guys are talking about AI on his episode. It's disgraceful.
You know how rude.
Right.
Let's... Someone that you will meet on the stag actually did a master's in AI, so you might want to pick their brains when we're away.
Very good.
Right, yeah.
Okay, I'm realizing that we have been recording here for quite a while, so let's swiftly move on. Plugs, I've already mentioned my YouTube channel, the usual. I'm looking to add things now about this new project I'm working on, so yeah, hopefully up more videos soon. Michael, I know you usually have stuff, if you want to.
Yeah, I renamed The Dark Tales. I just added my name to it because I think it's better for, like, branding reasons, just to make it more searchable. And, yeah, just to kind of, because, like, one of the big things about the podcast was to help me better have a better, like, online presence for, like, selling stories or books or something. So I thought it just makes sense to add my name to the title. It's not like an ego thing. Hope it doesn't come across as. But I've also, like, I sent out my book to an agent, but I kind of did it. I had regretted doing it because I thought I did it way too early and I didn't edit it up to scratch. I did get a very, very nice rejection letter back about a couple of weeks ago from, based on the first two chapters. For some reason, I felt compelled to print it and put it up on my wall in front of my computer.
Yeah, I think it's a good motivator, you know. Maybe
that's why I did it. I'm not sure why I felt compelled to, but I was just like, I'm just gonna stick this up, maybe,
because it's gonna be a bit of trivia on a podcast sometime about that.
But yeah, I'm gonna keep editing and keep sending it out, and if I cannot get it out somewhere, at least I have the podcast, then I have a method of getting it out, so it's not written for nothing. So the podcast has really acted as a vehicle for me to be able to write without feeling like it's for nothing, which was always a big hurdle for me. Now that I actually have an avenue to release things, it's kind of taken the shackles and taken a lot of the pressure away, so it's a nice thing to have.
What about the fact that you've got three other professional book reviewers here beside with you?
Professional.
Professional because we do this for a living, Jason. No, we don't.
3 hours once a month.
Michael, whenever you're ready to share it, I would be interested in reading couple of chapters.
Maybe. Yeah.
Has to be in audiobook format. Sorry, I can't review physical copies.
I do not understand.
Goes against my code.
Do you guys know there's like entire buildings, they're filled with transcripts of audiobooks? They call them books, and they call these buildings libraries. Hope I'm saying that right. Right.
You'll never catch on. Never.
Nah. Doomed to fail.
Like, how are you supposed to do the dishes and read one of those things? It just doesn't make sense.
Well, it would just fall apart.
Gets all wet.
The dishwater.
Think of all the trees that you're killing. Think of all the trees that you killed to print the book compared to the small amount of electricity you use to, you know, listen to a book.
True.
We here at the Audiobook Club are environmentalists. Go green. Any other plugs?
No.
Nope.
Nah.
Oh, wait. One thing I always forget, we should do this every episode, but we do not. If anybody wants to email on, our email will be listed below. I always forget to mention this. If you want to do any recommendations or anything, we'll have that down there. We probably will like get onto social media one day when the podcast grows a bit more. It just doesn't feel very worth it right now. I just can't be bothered for that, but...
Yeah, probably. I was just thinking that myself about 10 minutes ago. It was like, someone should really like take over that Twitter account and actually do something with it. Yeah. Or X account, sorry.
X account, and because we've never actually received a recommendation for email, the first person that recommends for email, we will do the book.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
There are some recommendations, but we just haven't ever engaged with any of them.
Journey to the Center of the Earth, that's recommendations from our friends, I mean Silmarillion. Jack recommended Silmarillion,
I think you Dungeon Master Jack.
Shout out to Dungeon Master Jack.
Right, it is getting late, so that's all for my part of the hosting duties. I'm going to now pass the reins to Jason, and he will give his next book.
Yeah, so as I sort of mentioned, this is my 12th episode of the 23 recorded, so I'm now officially here over half the way, and it'll be my one-year anniversary in May 2024, which is likely when we'll record the episode that I'm just about to host. So I have a right sort of let slip to these guys. What I was planning on doing this time. I know a few of us have actually read it before, so there's no point in doing a guessing game. I think, Johnny, you're the only one who hasn't read it before.
Yeah, I have not read it before, or seen the film, but I was aware of the premise.
Yeah. So the book that I am choosing, let me just get this right. The book is Ready Player One by Ernest Cline and narrated by Will Wheaton, favourites of everyone who ever watched The Big Bang Theory. The other TV show.
Wesley Crusher, you mean?
I liked him from the show The Guild and also Star Trek, which I've never watched, but I know he's
I never watched Star Trek or The Guild or anything else with Will Wheaton, and I don't plan to.
All I know is that he looks a bit like one of our friends from uni.
It does, actually. I know who you're on about.
We always
slag over it. Phil Featon.
Basically, our friend looks like a cross between Will Wheaton and Rob McElhenney from Always Sunny.
A sexy man, then?
Well, he's like, got the unsexiness of Will Wheaton.
I knew exactly who you meant as soon as you said that, Johnny. So.
No, we used to give him stick about that and... Like first year uni, and we always said he looked like Rob McElhenney too. He's like, Rob McElhenney's a good looking guy. I'm happy enough with that comparison, so we'd go back and compare him to Will Wheaton instead.
But yeah, that's us. Episode 24 will be Ready Player One by Ernest Cline and read by Will Wheaton.
Should we, out of the spirit of this episode, should we split this up into three parts?
And put some dodgy sound editing on it, some like dodgy effects, and we'll also add a whole new section that's nothing to do with the book, but is actually about the next book.
a romance subplot between me and Jason for some reason.
Not for the first time.
Well, until right. Then, see you on the flippity dippity doo.
See you on the flop. Tight.
See you. I'll not be late next time, I swear.